let this stand up.
And to have that threshold become by then.
And I think this will pretty much take us a long way in terms of accommodating most, if not all, the comments around the translation.
But Chairs, I'm sorry, can you give them a time?
Could we go through all the issues and we come to each issue, right?
Yes.
That's right, because it's on the left, right? Okay, good, because there are questions in the last.
Okay, well, thank you. Thanks, Chair. So, Chair, starting with the first item definition, Mr. Kremer laid around the issue of client and prospective clients, particularly what constitutes a client could be passed from one accountable institution to another. Precision on definition of client may result in unintended consequences in subsectors such as the Artemis profession and casino industry. We have therefore considered a possible solution here, and this is what we are proposing to the committee, that the definition of client and reference to prospective clients be removed from the deal and left to the accountable institution to determine in line with its risk management and compliance program. The second area around definition checks around the domestic permanent person and foreign permanent public official. This concern was raised, I think, by fellow committee members around the extensiveness of the definition in terms of including all the listed persons in the definition. We are proposing that we move the listed persons from the definition to Schedule 5 and 6 for both domestic permanent person and permanent public official, and to include a new section 79A to empower the minister to amend the list for the public consultation. So that's giving effect to one of the recommendations which came from one of the committee. So the second area of concern was around beneficial ownership. And as you would be aware, the industry preferred the thresholds to be attached to share capital similar to the FATCAP 10% and FATCAP 25% as a proxy for beneficial ownership. We have indicated and still indicate, Chair, that the threshold may be an important indicator, and just to spread an indicator, but not an absolute indicator per se for accountable institutions to consider, that does not automatically indicate who the beneficial owner is. The second point to make, Chair, is that the institution must satisfy itself that it is in a position to determine who the beneficial owner is through, among other things, its risk management and compliance program. Our proposed solution, therefore, Chair, is still not in favor of including a threshold in the definition. Instead, we suggest that the FIC and the supervisory bodies provide guidance with regard to the determination of effective control, and thresholds can be mentioned in the guidance note as one of the indicators. So I said earlier about additional due diligence measures relating to legal persons, trust, and partnership. The concern then was raised by the industry that they view Section 21B as very prescriptive, and that's going against the proposed risk-based approach. BASA in particular read the entire section to mean they have to identify and verify both national person owner and controller, thus not providing for the cascading effect of the section, and I will explain the cascading effect later. Second point, Chair, is that the industry did raise the issue around the compliance, particularly in the absence of a list of beneficial owners. The third point to make, Chair, is that the structured international standard does not require a country to have a registry of beneficial owners. However, they do indicate preference for one. So again, it's one of those cases where it's not an absolute requirement, but having a list is arguably unusual. Chair, our proposed solution, the FIT did manage to verify with the industry regarding the application of Section 21B, 3, 4, and 5.
but they are meant to apply in a cascading form. And that means that if you are initially required to identify person with controlling interest doesn't yield positive results, then you undertake further inquiries as per the next provision. So you find yourself applying in section 21B3. If it doesn't give you the desired outcome, then you will move up and consider section 21B4. If that doesn't also help you, then you move to section 21B5. Section 21B3 enables you to discharge your duties as per the legislation, then you don't need to should I repeat that last point, Chair?
No, I think it's about sharing, but it's not
really good. Okay. So, Chair, going to the fourth element around the ongoing due diligence, again, the concern was raised around undertaking ongoing due diligence for prospective clients, and also given the possibility that they may decide not to continue with the business relationship, which means then that the institution would have undertaken this extensive due diligence and only to realize that the client is not keen on coming on board, which effectively needs levels of resources. So we have had the industry's concern in this regard, and we are proposing to the committee that the institution itself determine when a person becomes a prospective client or a in accordance with its risk management and compliance program. So this relates to the definition, which is where we suggest the chair that we should do away with trying to define client and prospective client in the definition, and instead leave that to the institutions to do based on their risk management compliance. Chair, the last item on TIC versus PET, and this is around known close associates and immediate family members. Again, the concern was raised regarding the definition and that the list was too broad and deviating from PET's international standards, and that the requirements for due diligence in the onerous in the same areas. Chair, I think the important point to make is that we need to all appreciate that PET's standards and recommendations require a legal framework which compares financial and other institutions to pay special attention to business relationships with the We have therefore considered the comments from the public chain and hereby propose the following. Firstly, to note that it is quite important for accountable institutions to use whatever means are available to them regarding obtaining the relevant information from compliance. Again, the point I made earlier, Chair, these are issues which are not only challenging to South Africa. Internationally, countries are updating in terms of how best to give effect to some of those success standards and recommendations. So as we go on and learn from experience, we will obviously refine and update and provide clarity in terms of how we see some of these provisions being applied. So, Chair, our proposed solution is that, one, the SIC and supervisory bodies will regularly provide guidance to certify areas of uncertainty. Secondly, we have had buffer concerns regarding the extent of the definition and propose that reference to previous spouse, civil partner, life partner be omitted from the bill. Lastly, Chair, we propose that the provision in relation to domestic and foreign permanent persons applies only to business relationships and therefore exclude the single transaction. So, Chair, as you see, we have tried to be reasonable as Treasury and the FIC, and we feel that the proposal we have put forward in a way take us a long way in terms of meeting the various concerns which are coming from the industry, and we can still try and define some of the issues. So that's where we are, Chair, in terms of the outstanding issues.
Thank you very much. Let's start with the first issue.
it's on page, it's slide 4. Single transaction decision resolved, right? That's a very good threshold. Do you have in mind vaguely what a threshold would be in our expectation of it?
What volume is that? What would be a threshold? What would be too low, you're going to be too high?
Yes, as long as you don't hold it.
Yeah. What sort of thing have you got in mind?
Are you always going to let that
issue of threshold? No. See, I don't think it's right for treasury to just wilt either. Maybe you should ask a general question to guide the assembly. How serious are these problems in our country compared to, say, other countries? If there are, if there's an indication or there's an international FATF assessment, if we are, let's say, in the worst 20%, then presumably we should be more stringent in the regulations we pass. If we're okay, then, you know, maybe some of the things you're asking to do, the cost-benefit thing is not worth it. It's too costly and too unwieldy and too difficult to implement. So is there some indication to the international body, where do you hover? Peter, you want to respond?
Thank you, Chief. The FATF undertakes regular peer reviews of its members. So the last time that South Africa was subjected to that was around 2009, and the standards then were different from what they are now. Our assessment then, in terms of how well we comply with the standards, and where we do not comply, placed us around the 60% time, so just above the average of FATF members in terms of how well we comply with the FATF standards. The one area where we go further than the FATF standard is this insurance single transaction. And for the 10 odd years that the Act has been in place now, we've never set a threshold. We've applied all our requirements to every single transaction, no matter how small. And that's unusual in FATF terms. Most countries sort of set a minimum threshold, and that's too small to care about. Don't waste your time and effort on small transactions. In the standard itself, it allows countries to set that threshold no lower or no higher than $15,000 or pounds, US dollars or euros. If we take things like exchange rates and so on in consideration, that actually amounts to a fairly high threshold in Melbourne. So we would not be looking at that as a ballpark figure. I think we would be looking at more something around $5,000 to $10,000. And then we would have to take that as a consultative process and then we would have to engage between the national officials.
Can you explain how much we comply with the legislation, the regulations or the norms or the standards? What we are asking is there any study that looks at to what extent money laundering, terrorism financing and the financial crimes we're dealing with here exist in our country? That's the question. Although that helps. So in other words, part of the first 10 is there are 10 countries in the world being under 6 in terms of legal standards. In terms of the extent of financial crimes?
Jason, that's a very difficult study to undertake. There have been a few things that sort of face it against that, how much criminal proceeds are floating around in the financial system as a percentage of GDP. And I think the last time that was done was in the early 90s for South Africa, and it placed us, I think, around 5% or something like that of GDP. But
an international norm,
then what? It's more less than
okay, international. But that's nice, that's not helpful.
Okay, over to my question.
Okay, fine, thank you.
Sure. I just need clarity on the intention or the desired outcome out of this this amendment. Now, if we are going to be deleting or leaving out clients, the definition of
crime. Let's focus on this one.
Oh, okay.
This is a single transaction. I think you missed our meeting, understandably, right? There's a lot of discussion here, and these people from civil society, actually it's industry, we talk about public. Can I just draw members' attention to this again? You meant well when you said the public. It's actually not the public, it's industry. We don't have COSATU here. We don't have FEDUSA here. We don't have the NGOs here. It is really worrying how skewed the discussions with civil societies, the like. They're part of civil society, but they're very interesting in these issues. Anyway, look, let's come back to you. Makoshi, we'll come to your point. In fact, I'm also concerned about what you're saying. But on this issue of single transaction, we did discuss this last time. What is the view of the Fanatic on this issue of having a threshold? We haven't had it until now. The threshold is likely to be between 5,000 and 10,000 knots. Is there any view from the committee? Nobody has a view. All right, and there's no more time. Now we discuss this. I can't come up with some answers, so I think we'll accept it. Can we move on? Okay, next issue is definitions. Now, client, here we are, Makoshi, go for it.
Sir, I was saying, if we are leaving the definition of the client to the institution, then what is the objective of the bill? Because if you are saying the client, any institution, in other words, I may, as an institution, decide that today, because it's convenient for me, define the client in a particular way, that could be excluding something else. And I honestly don't see anything wrong with the way we have defined the client in the bill. Because everybody knows it's common for that anybody consuming services and products of a particular institution is a client. Now, why is the industry so opposed to the definition of client? I'm worried about whether this is going to be enforceable or not. Because if you don't have a definition, you probably, of clients, you may actually end up with having an act of parliament that is not enforceable. In the sense that when people have to account on why certain aspects happen, they will actually come with their own definition. And I'm not sure if it's the correct thing to actually leave that responsibility to the institution. I would rather probably think that we can have a, yes, maybe a prospective client that can understand that. But the client, in terms of how it is defined here, as someone who has entered into a contractual agreement, it's understandable. Prospective is very vague. I agree with the industry. But the client, I honestly am not sure whether it's the right thing to do. But I'm willing to be persuaded otherwise.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to just ask a very general question, but it does apply to the whole question of the definition of client and so on. In terms of the risk-based approach, each accountable institution will determine the risks and determine what a client for them is and so on. Now, in the event that there's an inspection and the assessment is done, that the accountable institution's risk assessment is not acceptable. There's no legal basis, it's simply not acceptable to people. What are the outcomes then for the accountable institution? Because if I were the accountable institution, I would then be very careful and be over conservative. And that, my understanding is the risk-based approach is supposed to make it easier and not be so conservative. And so in the definition of clients, I'm sort of broadening it a little bit. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, if that's not out of order.
It's not out of order.
So that I get a better picture of this, because if I can get some sort of comfort that it will in fact be less onerous for the risk-based approach to be implemented, including for determining who it is, then I'll be happy.
I understand. See, Makoshi, it's the same thing that I feel that Makoshi is feeling. Like, you're like just losing. And the question then arises that Makoshi is asking, which I'm also asking, is the notion of a client not quite fundamental to this problem? Does it revolve around the notion of client, or is it that we're misunderstanding? Right? So I think that's a good question. Now, what he seems to be saying, and I'm like, you're saying that actually if we do what you're saying in the latest version of sort of block the term, then it could have adverse consequences for a person who should be given some support, but because the institutions are so wary and scared about consequences, if they do this, okay, that person may lose out. That is the same. Can you just put it in 2D? I lost you. Not because you weren't clear. He said, I don't understand it. And it must help because he understands because I don't see the region. So if I'm being still, if anybody else understands, I'll ask them. I'll ask them.
Yeah.
So, what do you want to say about that? Go on, you say.
No, sir. You know the issue of risk, I was going to come back to it earlier on. I wanted us to talk about the sensitization of the definition of client. Because I also want to understand from whose perspective is the risk. Is it the risk from the government perspective or from the industry or the company perspective? Because those risks may not be the same. And if we are going to be defining our terms around what the industry wants, then we are defining ourselves out of relevance as government. It's like we are merely doing this for the sake of doing it. So this is why I say we need to get into that, because if we leave it to the industry, each industry has its own risks that are linked to their own goals and, you know, and desired outcomes and that sort of
thing. Yeah, this is altogether new. We've never discussed this, which is useful. It's completely new. I haven't thought about what you're saying. It's very useful. I'll just come and explain to you what you're saying.
If you listen to what you're saying, let's see more with whether it's essential
the word client or not.
Jim, if one then narrows it down to the word client,
supposing they're dropping it, so the consequences you think would be?
The consequences may be that indeed an accountable institution then identifies clients in a far more conservative and earnest way in order to avoid any kind of penalty when there is an inspection or assessment of their system. And that, as I understand the risk-based approach, actually is not what we're trying to achieve. We're trying to achieve an accounting institution being able to assess its own risk, which will be different from another accounting institution. And so a client here may not be a risk for a client in another institution. But what we may be doing, I don't know if this is true, is we may be forcing the accounting institution to be very conservative because they fear the penalties. That's why I'm asking, what would the consequences be if he comes along and says, listen, we don't like your assessment of time, just in terms of your risk assessment, you need to change it. What then happens about the clients who we're not identified as clients in terms of their risk?
Well, that's why he's dropping it. So that it could do what you're saying, but maybe I'm not understanding. Can you explain for you?
Thank you. I think I'll deal with client issue first and move on to the issue as well. The legal effect is the definition isn't in the Act, it's that the normal dictionary meaning would become the legal meaning for the term client. And if one looks at our definition in the Act, it's almost already a copy and paste of the dictionary meaning. So it doesn't take that meaning much further. But I think that the point then is that the institution would have to decide when a particular customer or a particular person in a scenario meets that definition or not. So is this person somebody that I'm going to enter into a business relationship, has formalized a contract to do business with each other, or is it somebody just making inquiries or shopping around or etc. So the legal effect of not having the definition in there is that one would have to apply the normal ordinary dictionary meaning as the legal definition of the term. And that's what the supervisor would have to do then as well, when they see whether a particular scenario where a person was identified or was not identified by a financial institution, did that person meet this legal description of that you find in the dictionary. So the question for the institution to determine on a case-by-case basis is more a timing issue. When does the person actually amount to meet that definition or not? How not what is the features of the characteristics of the client. The reason why we're suggesting to take it out is because it's such a generic definition in many events that we have in the bill, and in some instances we've pointed out to us that people do business with persons, or they engage with persons in the business environment which are not necessarily their direct clients in terms of the definition. So for instance, where an attorney does a property transfer, they act for the seller, but they also engage the purchaser, which so one of them is their client, the other one isn't. But they deal with both and they get information about both. So this would widen the scope of what they can do with it, actually beyond what the narrow definition would be. So there's a balance to this. Coming to the risk issue, and I think that's the fundamental issue of this legislation. The legislation is a balance between regulatory type legislation and criminal type legislation, because we're trying to strike a balance between using the financial sector as a means to combat crime, but at the same time hardening the financial sector against being abused for criminal purposes. So it's not purely regulating the financial sector for regulation's sake only. And I think that's where the context of understanding risk comes from. That the institution must understand its risk, but it's not its risk for failure or credit or being subjected to a fine by a regulator. It's its risk that a criminal is going to use its products for nefarious purposes. So he must sit and think about it, the business that he does, that all his customers benefit from, and how a person wants to exploit that, abuse his services. What would that person do? That's the risk that the institution must be able to identify and manage. So it is a risk relating to the particular institution and the type of business that he does, the product it offers, the geographic locations where he operates and so forth. But in assessing that risk, it must take account of the information which government puts to provide. The government has a set of priority crimes, which are seen as major threats to society. Government must make that information known to institutions, and institutions know these are the things that are more likely to occur, that are more likely to come across my desk than etiquette or things like that. So there is an enrichment of the information that the institution must have from the government side, and that's why the points are made in the submission that government needs to do a risk assessment and communicate that, the results of that to the industry. If that doesn't become the industry's risk assessment, but it must enrich the each institution's risk assessment. But in the final analysis, the risk assessment that the institution does must be particular to that institution, because that institution must then say, well, how am I going to pick up with somebody to take chances on my products and services? On the supervisory question then, and they actually try to engage with other supervisors that all play a role in this, so that we have a common view among supervisors how to respond to this assessment. But generally, especially in the financial sector, the understanding is that when a supervisor disagrees with an institution's assessment of risk, and the institution has missed something completely, or they severely underrated something as low risk, which should have been considered high risk, the institution should be required to remedy, in other words, to follow up and improve and correct the problem. That may not necessarily entail a fine. But at the end of the process, if there isn't remedial action or the direct result isn't reached, there could be a fine. And this is where there's been a lot of debate among supervisors internationally at one point how substantial that penalty should be, remedy should be used. The community is regulators find an institution on the first instance of the claim. Others have a more tolerant approach and allow the institution time to correct it later. And I think it also depends a lot on what the institution's explanation is for the decision-making process, whether it's clearly a misappreciation of the facts or whether they were actually trying to avoid compliance with any obligation. And that would also play a role in how severely the supervisors take the view of their non-compliance. So all these things need to be applied in a way that allows business to happen, allows business to flow, but at the same time harden business against crime. So that's a very difficult balance.
Thank you.
Chairman, just a quick one, please. The link between keyword transactions and leaving the AI to identify what is the plans and those things. Is there any concern there?
Not sure. I just wanted to, first of all, share with you that my view is that the definition of client record and the threshold are intertwined. And the reason being that we also have to understand that I know not everyone will agree with me in this one. You know, capitalism is one of the most creative economic systems. It's ironically, it's very creative. Now, if we are going to be leaving certain things out and leave it to them to, you know, decide, I foresee this thing, as a former banker, I foresee this thing. I have this client. This 10 million rand client that is approaching me, and I have this 50,000 rand client that is coming here that wants my services. I'm more likely to make more profit with the 10 million client, and therefore my risk assessment is going to be impaired somehow or distorted, because my main mission is the bottom line. And therefore, I know that the issues that we are dealing with are very complex, but I am saying we actually have to understand what we are trying to achieve from the government perspective. Because if we are going to be only be looking from the, if we are going to be approaching this deal from the industry perspective, it may end up defeating the people. And I'm just saying we need to be cautious, because the industry has interest to protect, of course. And as much as possible, and I agree with you, Madam Bandit, the industry, as much as possible, they don't want anything that is going to pin them down, you know, to say, you are not complying, to be held accountable that you did not comply here. Whilst we also have to make sure that we are sensitive to the industry, because the IB intention is not to cripple the industry. We want the industry to be our partner. So in as much as we want the industry to be our partner, we also need to remember what our objective is as a government. With this year.
Yeah, I'm going to add to what you're going to say. That actually, you know, you listen to what the president said last week and what the minister is likely to say tomorrow. I think the government, the majority party, I think all parties, feel there should be a greater space for the private sector to invest in economic growth and so on. Right? The system just cannot manage the state that growth party wants. So we, I think the first is right. We don't want to cripple the industry or anything. But, you know, at the same time, we don't want to, as you said, it's a very creative system. We don't want to be too old. And what I'm asking for, since I don't have an answer to what the person is saying, well, is there any way we can compromise somehow? As I understand, of course, you were not here, right? Unfortunately. I mean, I understand what happened, but I'm just speaking. What happened was, if I recall, one problem they had with the work
plan. I also remember
that initially, which means that something did that it lost or something like that.
Well,
tell us what you're saying. Yeah. I should know because I come from Cajun.
No.
No. Listen to me. Pray in this committee. We don't have translation.
What is it?
I don't care. I want to hear it from you.
No, look,
you should not intimidate people, right? I have said that for an accident of 40 years, that I don't speak English room is not acceptable. But here we are, we are no consolation. Now, I'm being serious. I think I have a right to know what you're saying. So, can you translate or shall I call somebody to translate? Which is what can you translate? Because I think Bridget is just one of speaking, right? So, all right. Somebody who speaks your Bengali language, will you translate? What is the
problem?
Let me help you. Yeah. It's not helpful. I'm not
worried. I think it's about faith. Yes, I'm a this is why I'm undertaking this chair. So
yeah.
It's very serious.
But what about how
you are going? You are saying to me.
Yeah.
You see, you are not here. But you know, you're coming with some little cushion, you know.
Yeah.
And in cushion, when somebody says something like
this,
you say, when the mouth bites you, it bites you, but at the same time, it kind of makes you feel that...
No. I tell people off when I have to. And the point, I'm being unfortunate because, you see, some of the things you are saying, I mean, serious, actually, it's not at all what you're suggesting, right? There's a wonderful piece by Manolete, did you see, in the Mail and Guardian this past Friday, about the faith singer. That a faith singer, it's a wonderful piece, right, for those of us not, it's a really good piece, it's in the center square of the leader page, about how a faith singer is always dual and contradictory, and has dark comments, so he could be praising you, but in fact he's also alerting you to some of your weaknesses, right? There's also a marvelous piece, by the way, for those of you interested, by Lester Chenger, needless to say, one of the finest intellectuals in mind in our movement, on the Black Land Burden in the Sunday Times, so those of you who get it. Now, to come back, you're very wrong, actually. You see why I think it would be nice if you were last week. The 2 weeks ago, I think you're calm. But I understand. I'm not making bad comments. I'm quite capable of that. And I'm going to apologize for that. As you know, I've been out so long. And I refuse to apologize for that. So the point is, you could have inserted that into the discussion. Those are quite original things. It didn't come up before. But one of the things that they're trying to address, Makoshi, and I'm trying for you to think through this thing, because I don't have the answer. You see, they are right. You were not here at the time, that's what I'm saying. You might have forgotten, you might have got an earlier glimpse of it in the public hearing, but the point about the use of the word plan is that if I understand how we have alarm on your seat, it's a generic concept which doesn't address the specificities of different accounting institutions. So what is a client for, let's say, a lawyer? Is different from a client for the casino industry. Is different from a client in the banking institution. Right? So, we then said, let's see if you can strike a deal on this matter. Because we, at least most of us, not all of us felt that it's correct. For a lawyer, remember the guy came, it was very good. He said, a single guy, or a woman, with a PA maybe, and nobody else. And then you're going to ask me to do this for one client, right? Then the casino industry said, are you expecting us? You know, you remember that whole argument. So what I'm trying to say is because you raised it and I raised it, the onus is also on you as politicians, not just on them, to find the answer. And I'm saying one of the aspects that they have to address, and I correct, is this thing. You've got it's very difficult to define a word that can cater for all the variety of forms of crime. And a different type or form of crime, my question, will have different obligations to it's easy for a bank to do something, it's harder for a casino industry, yet harder for a lawyer, right? So we can't just throw problems and raise very interesting contradictions. We also have to help them. So the reason I'm saying this is I'm reminding you of the public hearings and some of the discussion we missed because I want to help. It's simply the reverse. It's a really nice idiom, I must say, I like it. Now the thing is, what do we do? Because I would like to suggest my question, that you and Alpha are right, even though your advice is find the difference, but they are also right, the industry to make the promises, and you're right to say, hey, maybe the English way does profit. But can't we compromise? Isn't the way we can have it, the notion of a client, but allow for don't know. Can even a definition even do that, Jesus? I don't know. Have a definition that a minister may allow, or take it out of the definition. Put in the schedule, as you've done other conferences, and said, a client is this, but it's recognized in some form, there is a variety of forms, and that the minister will... He's all the time you might discover new categories. I don't know, that sort of compromise. Yeah. Think about it, Makoshi. Think about it,
Alex.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying.
That's one of the problems we have here.
Rather than the movement.
But this is a point she also raises. Actually, she raises it very nicely. It's about, at the end of the day, it's pretty minor, coming from my idea. You have to balance the risk for the industry. Well, which sort of government, I think she needs the public, for the whole public, the country, right? But you could say government, parliament, and other people out there, even the clients. And really, I that's the point I keep saying to them, of course, you don't wilt. I mean, make concessions, be reasonable, put in touch, but don't wilt. There's some things you have to defend. And parliament has to defend if you want.
So, Chair, I'll let that come in. I think we have tried to cock up and talk about it. I'll answer the issues today.
Thank you, Chair. I think one way of striking the balance is if we maintain the definition of client in the Act, as generically as it is there, which doesn't do harm, take it for a lot of flexibility. We propose that we remove the definition of the state of client from the
Act. Yeah, I think we agree.
And when we get to the section that deals with the risk management program, I think we're also proposing a clause there that the institution must include in each program how will we determine when it should be dealing with the client. So you must make that part of the risk management process to say these are the processes by which I identify when is the person going to become a client and when that triggers my obligations, because that gives the supervisor a test then that they can use to measure whether the institution's actions are reasonable.
What do you
hear?
Yeah,
I
mean,
is that the way forward, Makoshi? Good. So we said, well, right. Thanks for that, members, who made a useful contribution. Now go on to the next issue, which is what is it? Domestic travel and funding.
Yeah. My colleague, comrade. Jay suggested that we move it. What did you feel about that, colleague?
It's on slide 5 at the bottom, a little way bottom. This actually came from Chandi, if I'm correct, isn't it?
Yeah.
Chandi is not supporting our proposal, but this is not sure anymore. That's yours, Chandi. Can you put in brackets there, Chandi? Put all the way to the third, right? Tell me, no, that's my legacy.
You actually put words in my mouth. I've never accused a position. I ask questions.
No, you really implied. You suggested, by the way you are. That was a very good point.
I've talked to you before. I have not actually...
No, but you alerted us to that. It's a very good point. Okay, put it there in the apple. I think the amendment, Peter and Orlando, Advocate Jenkins, should we, as a new democracy, innovative, we can put in, prompted by a Christian in the world, right? Put in brackets. Prompted by a Christian from the Honorable Sandy Tobias Pokolo. We can put that in.
I think that's
it for a degree. Let's get a legacy. Right. Let's go to the next one. I think you all agree with that. That's my question.
Sure. I wanted to say, if we're dealing with the domestic community, is that what you're dealing with?
Yeah, that one.
Yeah. I think the proposal to me, It's a good one, and I would support it, because we are going to have the schedule, and we are also leaving, you know, the discretion of the minister to include that of when he deems it necessary.
Okay, thank you, Makoshi.
We go on to beneficial ownership. This is quite a complex one, eh?
Yeah,
this one. I was reading last night your stuff, eh? And the more I read, I must not read them, because the more I read, by faith, sometimes you don't read. Because the more I read, the more things exploded in my face. And I said, I didn't think of this. I thought, hey, this is something I have committed to. Okay, so here, I'm beginning to move in your direction, eh, of no threshold. You want to say something about Koshi?
Sir, this is a very difficult one. And because if you are going to be including the threshold is very, I'm in favor of the proposed solution. Let me.
Okay, good. My question was supporting it. Anybody opposed to it?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's just deserved opposition until we see the wording of the amendments.
Okay, now, before this is such a complex one, I would like the industry to come in, right? Because I know you all feel strongly about this. What we have agreed is that when we do the final version of the book, we will send it to you, and then in section or some form you will comment. But remember, you're not co-governing. You'll have to come up with something formidable and new. Then the committee will say, okay, this is correct. Vata is correct, Asisha is correct, whatever. But, you know, we're giving you a chance now. We wait for what National Treasury is saying. Do you want to say anything? Vata, Asisha, anybody? Yeah. So you're happy with that? Oh, so there's consensus there. All right, fine. Okay. Although we have to, even if there's consensus between you two, we may just do. And we can. That's all right. Okay, good. That's it. Next one.
What is he saying there?
Yeah.
If you compare the way that we relational, it's also in guidance.
It's in guidance. Okay. Thank you.
All right, good. Let's go to slide 7. Any comments on slide 7? Look at the proposed solution. What's your view, Tandy, Dikeleni?
I understand the concept of the cascading. Is there going to be an amendment to make that absolutely clear?
Yeah.
That's exactly my question. I'm saying, you know, clarify, if Bata, who's got all these millions of experts from all over the world, misunderstood you, then the problem is yours. Although sometimes they pretend they misunderstand. I'm not saying you. We've been here 21 years now. We know, you know, stakeholders say they misunderstand. Actually, not that they misunderstand. They don't agree with you, right? But here, I do think you must clarify. And we will certainly look at the change. Right. Sometimes we can agree. I'll just give this one. Ongoing due diligence. I don't really understand your proposal, Lucy, frankly, but let's see maybe other members understand. Do you want to say something?
Yeah, sorry, check. So just to clarify, so we have provided the committee with an agenda to the responses. So that's us
giving a sense on the proposal. Yeah, we give the policy, then we can close by clause.
Yeah.
We'll give the effect of the policy. That's the Masali's role.
Yes.
He will be helping the committee to change the notes and the changes. That's why we're there. Okay.
Can we look at proposed solution now? Colleague, do you understand that? Can you explain? Of course, let's give up that to you. I don't really know what this means. Is it proposed that it's okay? Okay, does anybody understand this? Let me give you this. Okay, please, you want to use it? What's it saying here?
I don't follow.
Hold on.
Yeah. Yeah, so there are one or two issues there. So the concern has been that if you want to be awkward of requiring institutions to do ongoing due diligence on the example of the transactions, but then they even the agents.
Yeah, the relationship.
So we have suggested clarifying that and explicitly that ongoing due diligence will only relate to whether it's a business relationship, so there's a continuous relationship between the business and the financial institution. So Chair, I think given the inner discussion, what probably then should read under proposed solution is that the institution itself determine when a person becomes a prospective client. I suppose you have to omit the foreign client, because we said that will be left under the definition in accordance with the Business Management and Compliance Program. So it's the element of the prospective client which will then be left to the institution to determine. Okay.
The way you're explaining makes more sense than the way you've written, but maybe it's me.
I
can't. You mean within the sea?
Yes.
They're not obliged to answer that.
They don't have to answer
that. Yeah, they don't have to answer that.
And then the second one, if it's very urgent for us,
you have to discuss that, remember. We
No,
we're not voting on the program. We look at the program. Have you seen the program? Yeah. Can we, we don't have the issue of when we're going to change the vote is related to when we vote on it. Right? So we agree that we're not going to meet the constitutional requirements of unnecessary immunity in the sense that what will come into effect is what is in the bill. I spoke to the minister as I was mandated to. I requested to the minister that he writes a letter as a courtesy to the court. I find it more than that. It's not an advocacy against the legislative issue. And we said we will not plunge into finalizing this bill. So if we need more time, we will execute. There's no urgency on this. And in fact, the next sitting on this bill panel is when the Money Bills Act process is over. I think that will be around the 8th or 9th of March or something. So, I think that we haven't got the program. Actually, we approved a bit last week, and you asked people to comment. The members have been given the program, most of them. So ask the comments on it. Okay, can I just say that you're not obliged to answer the question, but if you want to allow it, you're the head of the team. Can't be questioned. Are you in agreement or not? She senses...
No, they don't have to answer. I leave it to them to go in because
Yeah, we put it in the public domain, so they have a right to go to class.
So, Chair, no, I'm not aware of any divisions between the treasury or the
public.
Are you in agreement? Well, let's put disagreement.
So maybe that's the question. Is agreement between the two of us or between
you and Speaker?
I don't know.
So you ask the question.
You know, I'm not aware, but I'm very sensitive about certain issues. Where's the difference? I'm going to give you a question. There was a national strategy to end for high on the political policy. That's why I think that you must get deeper into the discussion on many issues.
Amongst themselves or between them and somebody else?
I did not mention any name.
Yeah, but just to clarify your question.
I listened to the interpretation and the explanation, and I'm just saying, don't let them answer.
I'm confusing you. All right, just, if you want to reply, you can. You were very diplomatic in your reply. You said, I'm not aware. You didn't say there aren't any. Just eye to eyeness, I'm not sure whether the eye to eyeness applies to eyeness to eyeness or it's eye to eyeness. I'm not sure. But it's fine. Okay, you reply. If you're not aware of any, there's broad agreement on the phone. There will be individuals, like we have in the commission, even in the ANC. Right? Let's go to the next point.
I hope, sir, we are not expecting national treasury to promote your junior.
Yeah, then it'll be answered that way. Then it'll be uncreated. Exactly. I hope you're not. Exactly. I mean, that's exactly how I feel. I mean, it's creature to be disagreeing. We disagree all the time. Right? But we have broad agreement within a framework within which we disagree. Okay. This is PIPS. Who's for PIPS and who's for PIPS? Okay, the proposed solution, colleagues, at the bottom of page 9, slide 9. Anybody want to comment on slide 9? Yes, Al. While the AMP caucus confers it.
Yes, Jim, just a quick question. I'm not sure if you raised it, but I think it might have been good services. I mean, who reiterate businesses, have they kind of had any input into this?
Yeah, I'm not in the moment. But first, okay, you can take that, but let's have comments
from the members, and we'll go back to sort of society.
Mr. Chairman, my initial comment is just okay, sorry.
All right, anybody else who say anything? No? Okay, I want to ask you a question. I don't really have a view particularly. Why do you want to remove previous files, civil parties, and life parties? Because often, not often, sometimes I see the media and so on, and I know from the world that I come from, which is the world out there, that people do that, exactly. They use the previous parties and so on. So why are you removing it? I don't know, I'm just asking you, it's just not to get to me.
Thanks, Chair. I think there are two reasons, Chair. The first one is if, and this is not in the definition, it's actually in the substantive section that applies everything we say about the person themselves also to other persons around them, family members and so on. If we say that about previous spouses and previous equivalents of spouses, that means as a general rule, whenever an institution accounts such a person, they must go through this particular step-wise process of first assessing whether there's a particular risk about this person, whether there's anything out of the ordinary that should point out in the direction of treating this person differently from their normal person. It's a bit more difficult to explain that, where you're dealing with people who have ostensibly ended their relationship with a person.
Ostensibly.
Certainly, yes. But to do that and treat all of them as a run-of-the-mill business, as people who could potentially be hiding something for the person, I think it's more difficult to argue. Secondly, it's more a practical reason. It's something that came up very strongly in the discussions of almost all the industry players. It's very difficult to find information about these people and their relationships, especially seen from the family member side or from a former spouse side. You know that this person was married to somebody or was a partner to somebody. It's easier to know if you look at it from the public figure side, but it's more difficult if you look at it from the relationship side or the related side. Because of that difficulty, it will make it very difficult to keep practical effect to the section in the normal course of business. Especially, we're trying to see how we can alleviate some of that pressure. It's the only point where we can accommodate some measure of course, to alleviate the practical difficulty of implementing this in this one area where we're talking about formal relationships. So that is a proposal we need to be considered.
To ask if you're FATF, what do they guideline?
They don't have specific guidelines on the context. I just say if your system covers family members and non-close associates, and then they give all kinds of examples of what non-close associates might be. And this, a former spouse might call in that family of a non-close associate if there is still some sort of known link between the person and the former spouse and the former life partner.
Hi, members, are you happy with this? You agree with it?
Okay, fine. Let me agree with it, right? The only final thing I want to raise is... Oh, do you want to say anything?
Why should I even know the best?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Absolutely. I hope you're not speaking from experience. I'm feeling you.
Now look, from industry, I prefer to call it industry, it's a bit of a misnomer for civil society, right? Industry, you're part of civil society, but you're not civil society anymore. Okay, industry, you want to say anything on this matter, or any other policy issues?
Chair, taking it to a schedule rollout,
yeah.
There are certain clauses that still in the existing law that will be taken to the schedule, it will still be unimplementable. And I'm only referring to the enhanced development that needs to take place in terms of verification in the absence of databases in which to do it. And it's something we strongly would need to engage further on.
Anything else
you
want to say?
Thanks, Chair.
Yeah,
I just want to say that there are certain solutions that have been highlighted on the discussion around these topics, but I think we still need further discussion around what actually gets in the definition, whether it's in the book or whether it's in the schedule.
Yeah, you can discuss, but we must move also as parliament. We'll give you some latitude, but you have to convince us. Personally, I think we've given the stakeholders a very good run of the legislation. And what we do in the final stage is the many things we got in the poll that we don't see about national strategy and parliament, and you pick up because you're the people there on a day-to-day basis. So that sort of stuff will allow. I mean, it's come up from the parliamentary, but we'll encourage you because you're not used to until now, until the 9th, right? So you've got the space and time. But don't come to us after the 9th and tell us, hey, we haven't met and we haven't seen the 10th and all that. Sort it out. And then that's the sense of cooperative. But be careful because we're moving towards like a trajectory. When you want to come to something new, it's going to be fundamentally new, that normal inner different sound out of it. But the question I also want to raise, then, that let us not forget that we're talking of transitional arrangements and we're talking of phasing in. So when we talk about making concessions to industry, we have to say, but also, it's not as if day one, when the president promulgates the bill, you expect it to do all of them. And those sort of things are something you and Treasury can negotiate around. But you have to come to Parliament, because I mean you can't yourself as the executive and industry do what you want and say, okay, 18 months later, all these regulations are to be tabled. Mr. Jenkins, the country, you see, that's the thing about Parliament. You must, with these regulations, have some measure of oversight. So having said that, can we now declare how we're going to proceed? We're going to actually look at the bill, clause by clause, starting from the beginning. We will have side by side this document and the longer document that you've got together with your addendum. So you can four documents at the same time. But there's a lot of overlap in the way we process it, and therefore, and some things are very straightforward and not being contested. So let's start with page, what is it, of the book. Page 2 of the book. And now once we adopt these things, we will not come back to them until sometimes you might get up at 3 in the morning and suddenly decide that clause 14.1b, she's not happy with it, and then she'll phone me, right? And get mad at me that I don't pick the phone up at 3 to 5 in the morning, right? Then we have to deal with that issue. Something would have to explain. Why is Bakosi laughing so much? Something would have to explain why exactly, when she had so many hours to think about this new idea, she didn't think of it. Now suddenly at 3 to 5 in the morning, you go to the boat. Let's go on. Maybe on the more serious note, Sandy, it actually did happen with the local government. Somebody did phone me. Somebody did phone me at 25. They phoned me at about 6:15 in the morning. And it was a very good point. But we couldn't proceed. Yeah, okay. Guys, can we move? Guys in the blue will take. Right. Clause 1A. Administrative sanction is straightforward. Can I go ahead and kick it off? The side of you and Jenkins are going to help me to ensure you do everything correctly and we're not coming back to stuff, even if Slomani here decides suddenly that he doesn't like the term. Can I just follow? Okay. So, okay. B, authorized officers. If it helps, I did read all of this last night. That's leadership, okay? And I found a few little things here and there, but for the most part, I'd like to say I did read it the night before. Although I was bored, but I did read it. What choice do I have as a chair? There's no rule that says, or no norm that says, a chair must not read the night before he or she finds it very boring. I wish there was such a rule, but there isn't. Right, fine. B, I read, and I think it's okay. Can I pick it up? Any views, Sandy? No. Sandy wants to know, did you have full, did you see actual you can read. You don't have to read, okay? I mean, I know you don't agree with me, but it doesn't mean... Give us a chairperson for permission to read. These people are so defiant. Forget the ESF. Like,
see. And yet, we're not a social nation.
Sorry?
please, Tisha, may I go? That's not a choice.
Yeah, ma'am. Give it a turn, ma'am. Can you still say ma'am?
May I go up?
No, ma'am. What is the word ma'am? It's such an archaic colonial word. It means madam, doesn't it? Ma'am is short for madam.
I'm glad to learn from the Vishnu.
No, seriously. Oh, are you Afrikaans speaking? Zulu speaking. Peter, where does ma'am come from? Madam. Beneficial owner fee is fine. There are negotiable instruments. But the thing I need to let members to, or most of you start out, is that we agreed because of capacity and time constraints, unlike CBC, we are not going to shift the cross referencing with the original act, Advocate Jenkins and Mr. Okay. D, anything about D people want to say? No? No? Yeah, sorry, I have to look at this here. Can we turn to page... Yeah, here this is. Very good. Can we turn to page 5 to remind us? This is a 4x4 summary. Now, on 1, there... Any comments on the comment and the response? It's on page 5, 1-1 at the top, comment, and then the reply. Can I ask you briefly to have members, I did my homework last night. Engagements with SARS are ongoing to harmonize the tax legislation as far as related to benefits ownership. What's the point of making it?
Jefferson, in the SARS world, there's also a term similar to beneficial. I think they call it controlling interest, personal controlling interest, that applies to companies that are liable for tax from foreign jurisdictions. So there's two scenarios where this arises. The one is, in terms of U.S. legislation, a U.S. company operating in a different part of the world is still liable to U.S. tax legislation. So they want the financial institutions all around the world to know that they have a U.S. tax citizen doing business with the company. It's liable and that they must report onto the U.S. tax authority. Now, in their world, they want the financial institution then also to know who's the natural person that controls this company, who's actually the tax liable U.S. citizen. So they've constructed a framework of agreements with countries all around the world where our financial institutions will report to our revenue service will report to the U.S. revenue service. So they want that framework to cover exactly the same concept as our legislation does, and we're trying to harmonize the principles.
Any points on the first point? These are no threshold, right? We've covered that point. The jumping, right? So point 2, the definition is broad. I think we agree with Treasury here. So we want, anybody has any comments? Point 3. Yeah. Effective control to be defined similar to other legislation. You say it may be more prudent to deal with the guidance. Right. I think we agree with Treasury. Do you want to say anything very quickly on this matter? Because effective control is significant. Afisa, Bata, JSC. Anything you want to say quickly? We're going to come back to this. Fine. Okay, good. So you have to do that. 4. That's agreed, right? So we agree as well. We've covered that. 5. Yeah, what does corruption watch mean? And what are you going to do about it? So my point is 5, so what are you going to do? You agree that they're saying the use of a quantitative approach to it is not, in other words, it's covered earlier, that actually it's a threshold level. Good. 6. Oh, so one proposed introduction. So we can note it. What else must we do? Great. Okay. Seven. Sorry. You got anything to say?
Yeah, not yet. I was saying maybe when we need to consider some of the
five.
Consider some of the inputs that we need by the
There will be here in this thing. You've included all the submissions, right? Yeah. We agreed in principle. The only problem we have got is that sometimes in the bill will be consistent with the constitution. Now that's simple.
No, not that.
But the rest of it we agree.
Yeah.
Okay. You'll be here somewhere. Sorry. You want to say something on that matter?
We are all happy about the question going into the guidance notes, but it's how does it become a must go into guidance notes? What obligation is there on the regulators put into the guidance? How does that?
That's a good point. Yeah, actually it's a good point.
Why is your colleague smiling at
you? Teacher?
He probably thinks,
oh, he's a good point if I hadn't thought of it. So then you thought, what is it true about all of us? You know, we say, I agree with you. What a brilliant idea. It's because, you know...
I think you're being sarcastic.
Oh, no, not me. Literally.
But let's tell you what. My colleague is getting irritated.
Go ahead. Well, you know these two people. They will give you.
But now you spoke to me for 18 minutes, they say, yeah. And what about all the stupid kids that are going to be teaching for 25 minutes? I don't know.
But go ahead, Peter. Thank you, Chief. There is nothing in the Act that says specifically on what issues guidance must be issued. And the authority or the power to issue guidance is dealt with in the main sections of the FRC, and that responsibility is given to the FRC in sections 3 and 4. But the guidance needs to serve the implementation of the Act. So if there is an issue that needs to be dealt with in guidance, it's, which without which the Act doesn't work, it's incumbent on the regulators to take note of that and to issue guidance. So we are responsible to what the industry tells us where they need guidance on, because that makes life easier for supervisors and everybody to understand what
it's
doing.
It's slightly different from regulations, right? Mm-hmm. Guidance is, it's in your self-interest to actually implement the law and effect the goals that you want to achieve, and Parliament has some measure of oversight over that. And so you have to issue guidance because, you know, we've got to get them to cooperate. Okay, that's a fair answer. Good. Okay.
Then we go to... can I suggest also to this industry, right? Look, what
do you want from us? We're going through every, even the most trivial one here, right, that you've made. So you can't say Parliament's not giving you the fullest attention, right? I would like to suggest that there are very few committees that do this. So don't you go to court on those that come to us. Because then we're going to go to court and say, I'll show up where in the world do people do it like this. But you're getting a very good deal. So there's also give and take from your side. And we have, I think, the decision on ourselves made significant concessions. So don't push your luck, to use a crude term that we all speak about in the real world.
The last thing the industry wants to do is to take their regulators to court.
No, not the regulators, to take the Parliament to court on a phone. I'm addressing a certain person here in particular, there's a subject, so I'll come back to that later. It doesn't come from the majority party. Right. I wonder who that is. Man, I was telling you guys in the study group what I was doing this weekend. Right, you stupid lady. Right. Now then, let's go on, colleagues, to the next one, which is, we're on, what number are we on? Sorry, I've got the thing. Right. We're getting down to 7. Registries. containing relevant information and should be checked by CIPC and be publicly available. Correct you all.
Yeah, but that's a banal point that you mentioned, it, right? We agree with that. What's the point? Okay, fine. We agree, obviously, who disagrees?
Right. Fine. Okay, let's see what's the next thing in the bill. We go to bill fine. Right now, here, we've taken the decision already, if I'm correct, right? And we have to refer to the amendment, which is in another table. Here we are. Here you have your amendment, Mr. Lee. It is there. What are you doing? You are explaining Constitution Clause 1 day. Fine. This is now we're looking at, can we call them A, B, and C? So we know clearly. Now we're going to use C, right? So A is the book. Document B is the clause by clause. Document C is the Financial Intelligence Amendment Bill. Amendment. Addendum, sorry. A, B, C. We're looking at document C. Fine. Allow me?
Yeah, sure.
The first point under C.
Yeah.
A,
so on trying just to qualify the initially suggested that
the compromise.
Yes, then we will provide some guidance.
So this one we're not accepting until we see your text. How's it out, happy? Right. There's no difference between us and that. If it's any suspicious, let's look at the wording because you know the case is sliding things there and so on. All right. If by the deletion we have to delete the council because it's gone. Goodbye, council. You can have a funeral service for it. A, G, domestic prominence in the influential person. Let's go back to document B. So where are we helping? What page would it be in the document B? There we are, on the top. Right, on the top of page 6, dominant, domestic, prominent, influential person. Right, the first clause, one in the exam where it is proposed that the list of persons is scheduled. Yeah, this we've covered, right? And all the sub-points they are covered as far as I can tell, right? So can I say we jump this one because we had an exhaustive discussion on this one? Okay, good. So now, we go to the next one, which is on the bill, page 4. Right, you see, because I want to give you a chance very quickly. Is there anything you want to say in the 6 on domestic prominence versus domestic prominence influential country?
No, I made the comment before, Chair, that you don't claim addendum, but you still need to discuss those sections that there's no databases for us to do in our intelligence.
And what's your reply to that?
So we had indicated that we would consider some
I would like, by the way, between Jerusalem, Jenkins, and yourself, also just to note the points for our report to Parliament. Because these are things we're going to put into Parliament so that the committee, in about 6 months or so from the time you hold you back and say, okay guys, on the issue of guidance, on the issue of regulations, on the issue of transitional provisions, how are you doing? In our report to Parliament, we should recommend to ourselves, actually, that we should mention that every 6 months, at least, we will call user to see progress in the implementation of this. So, how's that? So, now you're noting it. The secretary will also note our report. In fact, I think we have a division of labor to discuss. Who does what? Who sets the pace for what? But we all work together as a team. Right. So, we're done with this one. Then we go to H. Executive officer. Now, what did they have to say about executive officer? They were unhappy, I remember. I left some notes which they read. Kishimani, what was the short point there about executive officer? Sorry? Are you coming back? So we need to discuss the bill. There's probably a problem in front of them. I'm coming back, yeah? I'm busy. I'm just going to have to leave. Okay. Right. And we also have to cry because somebody's leaving us.
What time
will
you
come
then?
Sorry? You made two of them. They are better. Colin Edwards to begin with. Right. Right, so an executive, now, here,
Chair, there weren't any specific comments on agriculture, but it's part of that concept of the domestic common person that is...
Oh, yeah, that was an issue. All right, so we find the book here. Do
you
want to say something about
it? You just said the CEO should be given a common understanding of what a CEO means.
It's a daily reply to say something about it, not so common, if I'm correct. I've read things that I'm hazy about doing what I feel. Isn't that correct? You guys said, no, but it's not so obvious.
Absolutely. There's actually a specific definition in company law of what an executive officer is, by whatever title they call. Mm-hmm. And we're focusing on that.
Fine. So we agree with that. Good. Right. Now, foreign prominent public official, right? This one on legal purpose. Now, there you've got, it's a generic definition of legal person, right? Because here you talk of a single transaction. But you exclude a trust partnership or sole proprietor. I know that's a generic definition of it, is that right? Now, why do you exclude a trust partnership or sole proprietor? Explain to me.
In legal terms, a trust or a partnership doesn't have legal status. It's not a legal person as a company or a club or those sort of entities that can act in their own name without legal terms. So we deal with those specifically in the substantive sections in the Act on how you deal with a trust and how you deal with a partnership. But we can't include them as legal persons because they don't have shareholders in the control.
Oh, right, they don't have shareholders. Okay, any questions about that? Good. So that one we agree. Then we go to K, National Prosecution Authority. Any questions of the... No. You may have written it with the NPA, so you may accept the definition. L, non-compliant means... Yeah. I just said, I don't even have comments to me, it seems okay, I can't communicate it. Obviously, people pick up things that they don't see and come back. Does N, offense relating to finance business, straightforward. N, prospectus fraud, we drop in that term, am I correct? So we take that out. We just delete it all together, right?
Yeah.
And public prospectus means, whatever you think of the slide there, you will agree with this. This is correct.
In fact, I'm the one that I supported to have a more prospective client.
Yeah.
But there is another aspect that I want to check out in this case. Supposedly somebody wish to come in here to the interview, bringing communication about whatever amount, probably say multiple millions, and this person does not necessarily first want to have an undertaking that is not going to be present in any way if he does this or the project or whatever. Does that person qualify to be a client or a prospective client? He hasn't entered into any contractual arrangement yet. Then probably he decides that he becomes suspicious and he leaves with his test. What happens in a case like that? I'm not sure if you understand what I'm trying to say.
I think that scenario is actually going to happen. In such a case, the person would not be either a client or prospective client of the bank. But in the reporting sections of the
reporting,
there is an obligation specifically on institutions to report something like that as suspicious. Because in many cases the behavior of the customers to avoid being identified is what triggers the suspicion.
Haven't had examples where you've actually taken a cargo institution to court or penalized the patients for doing exactly that, not telling you that when they knew this person disappeared because they were worried about money that they had, which was not credible money or not legal money for them.
No, Jenny, we've not had any instance where the institution failed to report something like that.
But they have reported. Okay, then the next one is, what is the risk management
and compliance program? Blood program 42.1, up top reference and check, right? Special investigative unit, right? Now, the deletion subject here. Why do you delete this in Q? This means looking at the original act. I didn't look at the original act. It's still a few weeks.
What is it you?
The definition was in the wrong place in the, so it's actually the definition we discussed earlier that was inserted in a different place in the definition clause of the project. The alphabet thing was in the original text of that, it was in the wrong place.
Oh, right.
Yeah, yeah, okay, fine, fine. Do you have a view on that, though?
Why did they go in the wrong
sequence? Compliance program.
I'm just
looking at this question. Oh, sorry, I can't fix that up. Okay, what's the end of the O? Oh, yeah, no, you're right. It says non-compliant. The definition should take into account the risk they propose. And treasury reply. Explain that to us. We're going to explain a lot of Peter. We're explaining on page 9 a document B, non-compliant. Could you document?
Yes, but more important, the comment from civil service, comment from whoever, let's say in GCRR and JC. You see on document D, on page 9.
Yes.
The first point, and then 2 points. Respond to that? I'm not picking. I'm not picking. I just really understand what you mean.
On the first comment, we say that that is inherently what the supervisor must do, because every section where we say the institution must do something to include identified customers, we say they must do it in accordance with its own risk management program. So that, by necessity, incorporates the risk management program in what the things that the supervisor must measure against when they check non-compliance. So the determination whether an act amounts to non-compliance or not cannot be done separately from having regard to the risk management program of the institution as well.
Which CRR is it standard for? Which CRR? Is it money? Sorry? Oh, yeah, yeah, those people. I remember that. Arguably, two non-compliance should refer to criminal information. Yes, I see your answer there. Why did the GSC say that? Can you take the GSC seriously, right? I mean, they know everything, and there's no accommodation. For them to say it makes you worry. I mean, if the individual has said it from civil society, you might be kind of cautious. It's just a JSC system. Why do you think they said it? Why are you laughing at me? No, I mean, the JSC said it.
Wait, I mean, it's just a JSC. What am I in the box? What's the fun? Why are you laughing at me?
Why is the DSC being so serious? Okay, you can't answer that question. They are playing.
There is somebody...
Thank you, sir. Now, maybe, I'm not saying this is answer, but they actually view things through the listing requirements. The listing requirements include compliance with corporate codes, such as the key code, and it's mandatory to comply with most of those issues in there, although those issues are not in the law, in other words, in the Companies Act, take an example. So when they think of non-compliance, it is extreme. So this is my view. The system is really non-compliant with laws, the criminal sanction attached to it. Short of that is non-compliance with the listing requirements, which they certain have certain powers over to get delist you or to intervene there.
Oh,
so it's
maybe,
quite
yeah,
a
yeah.
different perspective that they
that's right. on their world.
But I agree that the comment is fairly easy to say that.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's not the way it's meant to say.
No, I agree with you, but I'm just surprised. Yes. Fine. Okay, let's go to the next point. We go back to the bowl then, to where are we now? So the left-hand prospective card covered, right? Okay, so there's nothing else. We go to trust. On R, okay? Right, trust is sorted out. Now we go to section 2 above. And here, there's no comment, right? Now the principal objective, look, does anybody have anything to say about 2A? You just expanded or enhanced your role, as I see, compared to the original action. I must say your memoranda are very nicely done, eh? Very nicely done. Congratulations. Sometimes when you read the memoranda, it's not so clear. You're very detailed as well. Very nice. Thank you very much. This is my life for it. The life of the community must be easy. B, I don't know what's so funny there, but fine. She's got the giggles, right? I mean, I don't know what she has to break this for me. Okay, so B, we put down all these things, and I've got a note here from a previous sitting. Somebody said the minister can regulate further bodies, but what do we decide on that? Here's where the Masani should come in and the secretary. What do we decide on that? Because my note says we pose this question. I don't know if it's official. Masani, do you have anything here? Yeah. So we're looking at the Masani at 2B. Colleagues, can you remember? This might have been Sunday, actually. Can you look at 2B, right? On page 6 of the book. Yeah. I've got a note here that says, ministers should regulate further bodies. Isn't that you who raised that? No. I don't know. Somebody raised it. Here's it here. I didn't make it up. You can see. Okay, let's ask a question to somebody who's got notes here. It should be pleased with the note takers to have their notes ready. Can I ask, is there anybody who wants to suggest that the number of entities here with which the FIT should engage and share information may at some stage have to be increased? So, we put in something here, clause that says the minister can regulate further bodies, by the time the elegance of the word, with which the FIT must share information through regulation. What do you say, Olana? This is government point. What is my point? Some member raised it. I can't tell this one.
I'm following the point now. So it was more along the lines of giving the minister discretion in case he wants, or he or she wants to include further entities.
Yeah, we say, FIT, shared information. Because you see, when you pass the original act, you may not have had EPID, or you may not have had let's say SIU. So you might find new organizations. And if, for example, the president mentioned that he engaged with business and wants a new anti-corruption unit set up. Business said it to him, I think, 2 Tuesdays ago, right? So we may decide in the state to set up a new body. Personally, I don't see the point because there's so many bodies and it works more effectively. But that's the decision of the executive and probably agree. So what I'm saying, shouldn't we have a clause, sub 11, that says, the minister may regulate further relevant bodies. Obviously, you can't regulate the charter or something. It has to be, you know, relevant to the state. What do you all feel, Alan? Hey?
I think from a policy point of view, our approach has always been that this is something that Parliament can bring. This information is very sensitive and can be, should be very
technically and all of them put together. So the thing is, I do remember you said that, and you said that's why you don't want the power to regulate you. His memory. He's right. He said all these things. Actually, you're right. I recall all of this. You recall things. Why did you say, but I have replied? And I'm not going to. Good. Okay. I think I agree with you. I'm very to see you.
I was just quiet because
you remembered what
I said.
We can have faith. Very startling. All right, C.
Because this is the mental requirement.
Now, this is straightforward, and I'll take this cross-reference to 26A. All right, colleagues on C, we're bound by this United Nations. Can we agree with it? Good? Okay. We're going to build the bill now on section 3A. Yeah, yeah. Basically what's
happening is previously you got information, now you can initiate, right? And obviously we would support that. Any comments from the public, as you call it, Olamit, the public? Aren't you flattered to be called the public industry? Right, here we are. Nothing on this one from anybody, right? So can we adopt this, please, colleagues? Right, so 3A is 5, 3B. The same would apply, presumably, that we can't have the minister regulate here, right? Okay. C, this is straightforward. So can we adopt C as a whole? Thank you. 4 we adopted already, you recall. 5 we adopted already. 6, 7, 8, according to my notes, we stopped at clause 9. What clause do you have? Clause 9. Okay, so the other clause have all been adopted the last time we saw you. Clause 9. Now, is there anything on clause 9? Yes, on page 30. No, that's accepted. So, right, on clause 9, it says here on page 13, a national risk is, oh, we've dealt with this already, right? Number 2, on document B, page 13, smaller firms will have difficulty implementing guidance and training. Okay, any comments on the comment and the reply on page 13 of document B? You think our reply to two, can I tell you rather good, right? They say to you, smaller firms will have difficulty implementing a risk. Your slip reply, guidance and training will exist. Some of these concerns. Anybody can say that. My stepson is 10 years old. He could say that. What does that mean? I mean, really.
He can reply. Look at this kind of reply number 2, right? You can put his reply to everything. Look at the last camera. See, other things that you, right? Look at the responses. Guys, these poor fellows come here. They fly to the town. They're too small. People at the risk space approach. You know what I'm saying? I'm sorry, man. It's so funny. My level. Okay, fine. Very good answer. You said it before. I'm ruling myself out. No need to answer it. It was under that time in the day. That we covered the first answer. I didn't remember the day you were not here. We were covering that ground. So I forgot. Okay, fine. 3. Proof of residence should not be required. The regulation is meant to remove this requirement.
When you mean regulations, you mean what regulations? Existing regulations. So how is it relevant to the public?
Chair, a lot of the comments about the onerous nature of the compliance burden takes the assumption that the current requirements will continue to apply, and especially one of the most...
Okay, it's not only to the bill, but it's only into the process
to then
okay, fine. So on the issue of Section 9.1, what are we saying? We're saying that what you have is fine, from what I can see. That's correct, a lot of... There's nothing we want to say on 9.1 that you want to change. Is that correct? I don't think that's the reason. I don't know when you should change that. Probably the first round, you know? I can't understand my own handwriting. But it's still definitely C. Somebody needs to question about C, right? If another person is acting on the other side, establish a verified identity of that other person. Or this is something I read last night. It's a little confusing. Can you read that, please? I think I picked up last night, sorry, that's what a person said. What is 9.3 reading? Can you explain in simple English? Who wants to explain?
Jason, that is the current section, not the way the act is currently. What it means is where the customer deals with the institution through an intermediary. So the person that the institution sees in front of them is not actually the customer that they deal with. So it's somebody else behind the customer that will actually be in this contractual relationship. Then they must understand who is it that they have in front of them, what that person's authority, and then also know who is the person behind who they're dealing with. That's going to be the actual customer that they deal with.
Yes, but
that's
not the question.
Yes,
the question is what is the relationship between the customer and the
institution that they deal with. So they must understand how it's the identity of those and what the relationship between those two parties. So that they have a good picture.
No, I understand all of that.
But I'm asking what is the relationship of what you say and C, Roman numeral 1 and 2. If you're saying this is an original act, as indeed it obviously is, because you look at your way you drafted this thing, and it hasn't been misunderstood, and it's been understood, good, let's move on. Who am I? Let's move on to K. I don't understand the way you formulated it, but I can see what you're saying. The way you formulated it, but odd, but hey, you said it's not being misunderstood, and it's being understood on the other hand, clearly. Let's go on to 10. Right, clause 10 on page 14 of document B. Right, you did use the prospective clients. We dealt with this property as well.
You know, okay. I'm sorry, I'm taking the
case.
No, please do. I'm going back to number 9.
Yeah.
You know, there is something that I'm not sure if we have adequately associated as the government. So the fact that you have, I mean, the network of individuals in South Africa is a dispute because people who live like in tribal settlements, they may have huge houses that will probably be worth multiple millions. But those, simply because they have no traces on that, or, you know, they only have the tenants of the tribe or the local chief or something like that. It does distort the network of individuals. And the reason why this is becoming relevant, especially in the, in, I know it maybe it's a small thing, this thing of address. But this issue of an address, this act has the potential of actually beginning to force us as South Africa to go towards formalizing those settlements, if you know what I mean, so that they actually have addresses and possibly even going to an extent of addressing the skewedness of the network of individuals in South Africa, because there's a lot of assets sitting there, and as a result, you know, municipalities are deprived, and remember, I have my own bias towards this. Municipalities are not getting the property, are not getting property rates which they deserve from these households
simply because we have not like brought them on the formal fold. And probably we do need to consider those factors going forward. And I'm saying, in as much as we are leaving this out, we need to be thinking about the future. Probably this would actually assist in beginning to move towards that direction. Because we can't have more than 40% of you know, land that is, you know, just sitting there and unaccounted for, you know. That's my view.
It's a bigger issue than the stone, actually. But I mean, you've raised this thing. By the way, when we purchased the property rate stock, we felt very strongly about it, the AMC 70. In 2004, around April, it is not acceptable that you have people who run huge assets. The poor working class people in Soweto and Sabantu and in Bali and in India, they are not looking for property rates of what property above a certain key. And that is
good.
Now, what about the question down the road? That is what a building that's three times, four times worth. What a rebuilt, adapted, refurbished council of city council in Bali. We were very unhappy.
But sure, you also have industries that are going to
this
area.
Yes, you made this point before.
They don't.
Now, you're very right, actually. It's unfair. It's a matter that your party, the team, because you raised it then, and I can't repeat to you what the sponsor is.
You mean.
No, you're right, but I'm not sure that we can do much about it. But you're correct. Absolutely correct. And there's a matter we should raise. 2017, July, next year, the public culture. Now, we're going to close 10. Understanding of obtaining information on business. Look at document T. Now, here we're dropping the prospective client. Now, I don't understand. The first one says requiring information from a prospective client is confusing. Using a comment will be provided after further consideration. Green. Are you going to come back to us? Because you're going to vote on this bill in the next few weeks.
What are you now?
Page 14 of D. D is the comment document. Look under 10.
Okay.
Now look, Makoshi and colleagues at 1, and look at their reply to 1. Comment? Yeah. Can you come back to us on that?
That is the comment that we made before the previous discussions we had, especially at the last workshop.
Right.
In fact, the portion is very and our
proposal is
overrides.
So was the question around the obligation of financial institutions, you know, the confidentiality relationships that exist between the financial institutions and their clients, probably discussed in terms of this particular question.
Not in relation to the specific talk, but the issue of confidentiality of customer information has come up in the most recent discussions, and the issue that features a lot in discussions is the issue of the banking industry. And it's not so much about the bank's protection of the customer's confidential information, but the customer says, I don't want to give you this information because it's my personal information. Why do you as a bank need to know what my source of income or whatever that may be? And that really is a problem. From the banking industry side, there's been a request that we must actually somehow insert an obligation on customers to provide the information. But the policy problem with that is it's unenforceable. One can't criminalize the customer's behavior because they refuse to give information to the bank. I mean, there's no way that one can say that the act requires you, and therefore, if you don't do it, this is a consequence. The only consequence is the bank must say to the customer, sorry, that I can't do business with you. And that's a very tough discussion between a financial institution and the customer to have, because the customer says, well, then I go down and do business with somebody else. And we need to have a regulatory framework that makes sure that every institution that they walk into will demand what the industry requires, so that the customer can't move from one to the other and find a way.
increasing benefits and so on.
Yeah, okay.
Good question. Can we then look at now, from what I can tell, I asked this before me, so I won't ask it again. Ask outside the meeting. I'm still not convinced. You need last night. I still didn't follow that. Look, I won't bore the meeting. The questions that I raised before got answers to, gave in on, and I'm not sure that I'm still understanding it. That's different from having a new idea or policy. So I won't bore you. There's a set of things that I'll meet with Olano and Peter and anybody else outside of this meeting. Because I'm worried about a word in there, but it's something that I don't think is a big deal. Can we then accept that for now? Sorry? We're accepting clause 10. Right. With the recognition that... So you want something on the left? The amendments you've got there at the bottom, right? You move 3, 4, and 5. Right. And what is the effect of that? No, no, no. I'm looking at the wrong thing. Sorry. We're looking at clause 10. Understanding and obtaining information on business relationships. Now, where is that? You see, okay, sorry, here I'm moving too fast, right? The point I'm now referring to is the relationship in clause 10. Have you got clause 10 on the book? It's on page 7. Right, it runs into page 8, right? Now, I have some problems with 8, A and B. I feel they overlap and so on. I raised this before. The officials dismissed it. Last time it struck me, I just don't understand it. I said I will raise it with them later. So, I'm saying, until I can come up with something, let me not bore this meeting. Now, if you look at that first part of 10, that is, it's 21A, that we are accepting. But you move to 21B, colleagues, this is a very big one. Colleagues, are we following? I think in the case of clause 10, if Makoshi and Dikulay can use your cooperation, please, man. Because this is a very difficult one. You see, instead of using clause 10, just 10 about 21A, 21B, I think LP are right. Let me say 21A will accept it. But 21B now is a big one. Okay? So I'm sorry about that. Yeah, wait, 21B now is a challenging one, right? How do you got a lot of questions then? Now, 21B, can you go to document B on page 15? That is the comments first. Go to page 15. 21B. Right. Let's look at your course 10 there. So, that's why we go to close 10. Oh, I see, you jumped ahead of us. That's why we're sorry. Very unfortunate discussion. Right. Now, can you help us to go through this? It's quite difficult. Why is your, what's her name? The lady next to you? Kumendi. Kumendi. Why is she smiling at all times? Why does she know that we don't know? No, the shepherd is there. I have shepherd. You ask the question. Seeing eye to eye. Kumendi. Are you seeing eye to eye with Peter? You don't know what you're starting to get. See, now you see eye to eye with Orlando. I'm shooting the eye. Right? And there's something about Kumendi. She's not
eyeing.
No, I know what the subject I want to say is. In fact, when we get starting to meet here, one has off 25 months. I think I'm going
to
ask you. Well, no, I will ask you privately about that. Right, okay. Fine. So, go ahead, Peter.
She understands it all better than any of us. In those things says a whole number, I think, 8 different sections in that. So, and difficult that eventually inserted in the translation after the falling on the floor is eating the ball. The 31B is the one that's been the subject of the most discussion between us and the industry. This is the one that deals with what the industry needs to do about the beneficial owner. And as Olana said in the beginning, what we can see in the discussion is that there's actually not much of a difference in what we understand the principle that the issue should be doing, or in ways it's very understood. So I think it's actually sort of step by step.
And this was subject to a lot of consultation, colleagues from this. So this we have to get it right. And that they will understood it, or is a reflection on the draft in particular. So this one is quite important. Please, everybody help.
Chairman, basically what Clause 21B requires of an institution by dealing with a legal person, in other words, with a company, is to do two things. The one is understand the structure of the company. That is what subsection 1 will provide for. So that refers more to the hierarchy of ownership for the company. And then subsection 2 through to 3, 4, and 5 together contains the second principle of what the institution must do, and that is identify who the beneficial owner is and do what's reasonable to verify the identity of that beneficial owner. 2 spells this out as the principal objective, and then 3, 4, and 5 gives the institution the cascading effect that become part of the discussion. So there are 3 different ways in which the institution can identify who the beneficial owner is, in other words, who is this person whose identity is identified. And they need to apply these sequentially. So they go first to option 1, which is clause 3. If that answers the question, then they don't have to carry on with the inquiry. Then they verify the person who's identified in this. Talks about who has the majority ownership of the company. And in the guidance, this is also where the threshold issue will be dealt with as one of the indicators of percentage of shareholding that might lead you to answer this, who's the beneficial owner. But in many cases, the majority ownership, whether it's 25% or 50%, whatever, is not a natural person. Or if it is a natural person, that natural person actually has no say over what happens in the company. That's an exception to the general way that companies operate. But if that occurs, then the institution must move on to subsection 4. It must then look for some other arrangement which determines who controls this company. If there's just a layer, 3 or 4 different companies of shareholder, and there's a natural person at the end of that, then that's the person that they should identify under clause 4, subsection 4. Or if there's a shareholders agreement where 3 or 4 shareholders agree to block their voting powers or vote in a block at general meetings, then that will be the arrangement that determines that control, which the institution needs to identify. If neither of those 2, 3 or 4 provide an adequate answer, then there's a default position provided for 5, which where the institution then actually says, well, I can't find the beneficial owner, I'm going to make an assumption. And the Act says the assumption that they have been made is that the day-to-day management, executive management of the company is the beneficial owner. So the CEO or whatever is the top layer of the company that determines its day-to-day business. At the back of all this, the principal objective that we want to achieve from a money laundering combating point of view is that whenever there's a legal person that deals with an institution, in the institution's record there will be a name of a natural person that can be held accountable to answer for who actually runs this company or who draws the ultimate benefits from this company. In the majority of cases, that will be the person who actually runs the company or who actually benefits from the company. But in most exceptions, especially when we get to subclause 5, where we know it's not the real person that we're dealing with, we have a person that we can say, if you don't tell us who it is, we're going to assume it's you as an investigator. From a law enforcement perspective. And then we then hold you responsible for what this company does and the crimes that have been committed in this company's business. So I think it's
the end objective is to make sure that companies that don't become a fake institution where you can't see through them, and where there's no transparency as to who the controlling minds and beneficiaries are from the company business. So that's what we try to achieve with 21B1-5. The rest of the section 21B then goes on to apply a similar concept in relation to partnerships and trusts, which are not legal persons but also are groupings of individuals working together and in the name of the group. So partnership acts in the name of partnership, or trust acts in the name of a trust, although it's not a legal person. And the principle that's applied there is that the institution must again identify who these natural persons are that are grouped together in a partnership, or the controllers of the trust, the trustees of the trust, and then again to do what's reasonable to verify those identities. And then some of the examples that came up, for instance, were very large partnerships, for instance the professional partnerships like the consultancy firms, etc. Where it would be very difficult to verify the identity of each and every partner, but it's not that difficult to establish from the information that's available on the database, for instance, who the trustees or who the partners are. And then find out from this partnership who's the one that actually manages this partnership, where does the mind and controls it, and to verify the identity for that person. And then the same with very large charitable trusts, which have a lot of figurative trustees to gain credibility to the charity, but where there's actually a small group of people that a board or something that controls it. Again, we are often knowing who's controlling the business of the trust, not necessarily who are all the trustees and the figurative on the letter. So the way that the institution is to manage this would be against, say, if it's a large charitable trust or well-known consultancy firm that operates as a professional partnership, those are not likely to be the institutions that will be used to loan the money to my business. So I don't have to go to the end of the world to find out who's behind this. But if it's a private person's family trust that may or may not be used for tax evasion or may or may not be used for if you obscure the ownership of property, then you need to ask three more questions to understand who's controlling the account or the property.
More questions?
Chair, it is our intention to exclude society, there are lots of societies that are established that are not necessarily having that way you can hold one person responsible as well. And you have a lot of that in the township where you have this thing in terms of societies. And then with whoever as a society, but sometimes not necessarily having the natural person to stay behind them. Is this factored in or what?
Any other questions, comments? Okay. Yeah.
Yes, societies are a difficult entity to work with because in many instances society is constituted as a legal person. By its constitution it has, it can open a bank account in the name of the society. And that's often true for things like sports clubs and the likes as well. They function very similarly. In those cases, the institution would have to do is understand who is the natural person that represents this body. And we have to find out on the account of this. And that will be considered the beneficial owner that needs to be held accountable, because here you don't have shareholders and structures and so on that own the legal person. It's actually not only just functions as a group of people with a legal identity. In other cases, societies actually are not considered legal persons. And those are the ones that are very difficult to deal with. So there's
allocated one can probably have been considered in a partnership, but they don't actually have an existence in our legal terms, language and terminology. In that case, if they have no sort of constituting factor that binds them together as an entity, the institution would have to go back to what we had in clause 9 in section 21, where you have one person acting for another, so that they have to understand what is that relationship. Some person acting in their own name or acting on behalf of the, from the alter group of people. So those would be the sort of scenarios where it's not a partnership, it's not a trust, it's not a company, it's not in any form of legal system, it's just an interaction that one person will be in a agent for another. And again, yeah, the institution then needs to understand what's the nature of this business. Is it, or is it even a business? Is it a non-profit organization? And determine whether there's any risk in this type of entity being abused to launder money through the business. Normally, if it's a tennis club or a federal society, or the likelihood of it being used for laundering money will be fairly reduced. So the institution would not have to sort of go through layers and layers and layers of information to understand who they're dealing
with.
You know, there is a case that there is a case in my province where you find a person that somebody who is unidentified has bought land, 25% of a farm, but it doesn't go through the deed registry or something like that. The only thing that they have is a shareholder agreement that they both of them kind of drafted with the aim of hiding the thing, you know, that I'm actually, it's actually a very silly bribery case where, you know, somebody said, no, this money was came to me because I actually sold 25% of my farm, but that 25% is not necessarily, it doesn't change the ownership at the big office. In a case like that, what have, who is the beneficial owner here with this particular individual, or this unknown individual becomes, I don't know, I'm just, it was just an intriguing case that I come across, and it relates to the specific case actually.
The question of who's the beneficial owner, I think is very closely linked to the proportion of benefit that one derives from an account or a property or something. So the approach that we take from a money laundering point of view is the one that has a significant portion of that is the beneficial owner. So there are minority shareholders or minority beneficiaries, those are not the people that we are interested in. If we know who the person is that has a significant benefit from a property or significantly exercises control of the company, that's the person you will want to go out and investigate. Then you're the guy that's responsible for what's going on there.
No, it's a very good question you raised.
Very original. But
see, these things, although I think members should feel free to raise these issues, right? Because the influence of shaping of other legislation, things we haven't thought about. Anything else on 21B?
Yes, to the point that we made earlier was the clarification that it was a cascading provision. I'm reading the amendments, it's on page 3.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm not getting that
clarity. Exactly. I would not the same thing. I don't see how. You see, if I understand, never can see how.
It's difficult. You see, if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is, three comes into effect. If three doesn't work, am I correct? Then four comes into effect. If four doesn't work, five comes into effect. Now I'll use the word in four. If an account is in doubt, look at the first line of four. If an account of an institution is in doubt, then you would effect four. Then you go on to say five. is unable to identify, having done three and having done four. Now, I thought you were going to make it simpler like this, like in my head, last time. If you're going to say, and that's why I don't understand how, and that's the else one, how by swinging around in one sentence, three, four, and five, is that clearer? I thought, to put it crudely, you'll find the elegance, you're a legal doctor, you would say something like, if three above does not achieve the required goal, comma, then you will do that, right? And then you come to five, if still further, four doesn't do that, then. Now that's not elegance, right? But it's clarity. Now how you put it, you know, now what you've done, colleagues, just see, I'm very cautious about adopting this thing, because last night I just didn't feel that it does the thing. It's not clear enough. All you've done, where's the page? Don't turn this one, yeah. All you've done is actually, if you look at page 3, colleagues, look at what's in red, right? You move subject to 3, 4, and 5 down the sentence, but it still doesn't make it clear. It's sequential, or the one is contingent on the inability to do the previous thing. You know what I mean? Peter, a lot of help up here?
It's actually very difficult for us to come up with a different drafting, because we've always intended this original drafting to be the idea that it's easy to change the application. We've not changed our mind.
We've always wanted to work.
Sequential application of 3, 4, and 5. What we've tried to do with the movement of the reference in subclause 2 to subsection 3, 4, and 5 is to say, when you apply subsection 2, you must do it in accordance with subsection 3, 4, and 5. So placing it after in accordance with, we try to say, when you read subsection 2, you must read it conjunctively with 3, 4, and 5. The sequential nature then lies in 3 and 4 and 5 each, because each one says, 3 says, when you read 3, it applies subject to 4 and 5. 4 says it applies subject to 5. So when you read 3, you must also understand that 3 applies if 4 and 5 doesn't apply. 4 applies if 5 doesn't apply. So in terms of legal drafting, we couldn't find a different way of saying that you apply 3, if 3 doesn't work, then you apply either 4 or 5. If 4 doesn't work, then you apply 5. But that's definitely what we intend. And if this needs to be explained further, not in legalese and drafting terms, then that's what guidance needs to be doing. That's the sort of discussion we had with the industry. That when we formulate this explanation, to make it clear to everybody that will read this, instead of trying to write 10 pages into the act, we should put that explanation in proper guidance that the industry be satisfied that it is plain to be adequate.
I'm not convinced by answer, Peter. It can be done simply. We've done this before many times. I think we're all agreeing with the... if you're telling me what you just told me, why in the first instance did they misunderstand you, right? You're saying it's subject to. I would like Advocate Jenkins, Peter, who are the other lawyers in your team, Olana? Wait a minute. Look at this thing, and I don't need to vote on it. I'd like to recommend we don't, actually. That you can make it clear. Just by speaking words again, I'll also look at it, right? I will have only time on Saturday or so. Look at it. So I will come back to you by Sunday evening with some proposals. But in the meanwhile, I would like Advocate Jenkins from our side to look at it and see whether you can tweak the words. If you've got a proposal, you can send the email to me and to them. I think we can improve it. I don't know what you've done enough. I'd like to strongly appeal to members we don't vote on this stuff now. May I ask why we're at this? Is that your team or your colleagues or your adversaries? I don't know why you qualify yourself. But the industry. Are you happy with the formulation here?
Not the way it's written before.
You
feel that the
scaling
effect is not coming
through. Yeah, I agree. And my guidance may help. I don't think the legislation of a banner is a responsibility to produce legislation that's simple, clear. One of the advantages, colleagues, you may not know,
that we had, this country, is because we came to democracy in 1994. We were able to learn what are the stuff we did to Rusia. Nobody talked it. You know, we do that stuff about us writing legislation. So if you look at our constitution, it's a marvelously well-written constitution. Beautifully written. Simple, clear, you know, precise. Obviously, the legal interpretation is always, right? But the point is, it's very nicely written. You look at other constitutions. Oh, see. I think it's one of the nicest constitutions, up to at least 1996. Right? Now, in our legislation, even the municipal, well, the Municipal Structures Act is a fortunate act because we had to circumvent the constitution. And we only got ejected on two clause, we got to get it. We had to, but look at the municipal systems firm, and even our body, very nicely drafted. Your financial sector regulation book. Nicely drafted, simple, clear, although highly contested. So I think we owe it to ourselves as a legislature not to accept. It can be done, it's been done a million times since 94, simpler. Not because we went to use it, it's just interesting to hear. But we ourselves, it's our obligation to make legislation clear and as simple as possible, and I don't think we should drift away from that. So I'm sorry, we're not going to accept this, but it can be very quickly done over the weekend or less than time. Yeah.
So, Chair, yes, I think that's fine, Chair. I think if you could probably suggest some way
out.
No,
Chair, all the lines you know the description of the sophistication of the legal profession is too complicated.
By the way, as far as Systems Act, I literally rewrote sections of it in simple English and I gave it to Petro Bauer. And then he says to me, "Dear person, do you know why you can do this? Because you're not a lawyer." And he's right. If I'm a lawyer, I'll feel the same. And then if you have to write the thing, you write it simple. So maybe the law also. Yeah, okay, good. By the way, you owe a lot to Willy Hoffman. He did a lot of stuff on, you know, writing simple, right? And he was the guy that led Parliament's project on writing simple. I think he went to do a course in New Orleans and so on for a month in 1994 and so on and so on. He was really good at simplifying stuff. He was a politician,
well,
not acknowledged. Willy Hoffman, come here, Willy Hoffman. Come here, you're the activist. He was the one that first raised on a hunger strike. Now, colleagues, we are moving on. We can only go to call to one. I think, so we haven't got SMS yet, but we've got a meeting from 1 to about 1:20. Study group. Now, can we go to the next one, which is from 21C, the ongoing diligence story, right? Which is another one that had some issues, as I recall. You'll find them on page 20. Right. Refer to clause 10 in addendum. And let's go to the addendum, and let's go to 21C. Right, yeah. Right, the first issue there is casinos, yeah, we accepted that, huh? It applies to not single transactions and so on. We covered that ground many times. Any questions you want, please? Comment? No? Comment 2 on page 20. Right, you say you do not agree that 1 and 2 are two different requirements. Could you explain that? There is no response to the comment 2 there on page 3. Peter, okay. Peter?
Thank you, Chief. The Roman numeral 1 refers to an institution understanding whether the customer's transaction over the idea of time, the way that the pattern of transactions over time, make sense of what they know about the customer or what they think from the customer when they started out their relationship or might have updated that information during the course of their relationship. So they open the account for Peter Smith. Peter Smith has a salary that is paid in about on the 15th of the month by the 20th of the month, and debit orders have gone through and the account is empty. That pattern repeats itself every month. And suddenly, the pattern of behavior starts changing. Peter Smith starts getting payments from foreign jurisdictions or doing transfers to offshore jurisdictions, etc. Then, obviously, he's no longer doing what the salary kind of does. He's maybe doing what the import-export business does, or he's maybe doing what the criminal does. So then the institution needs to pay attention to that and find out whether there's anything that they need to update about their customer knowledge, or whether there's anything that they need to report as being suspicious. So that's what the Roman numeral 1 refers to. And it's sort of an ongoing issue of updating and comparing information. 2 is more dealing with sort of the odd exception. So they know your transaction behavior or takes place in a certain range of values. And suddenly there's a transaction that's completely out of relation with that. 10 times the norm or whatever the case might be. So that's not on a BIA change, it's sort of a single spike that triggers something, or that suddenly the complex transaction is something that could be done fairly simply, transferring money from one person to another, suddenly rooted to 3 or 4 different entities, etc. So it's not an ongoing pattern, but it's a spike in behavior that's anomalous.
Okay, members, what do you think?
A question relating to the consequence of a client being a client for a long time, an unusual Roman 2 transaction taking place, and the institution then approaching the client and asking for an explanation, and the client saying, well, I'm sorry, that's one thing, so I'm not going to tell you. Does that then put an obligation on the institution to cancel or to terminate that relationship, or is it simply a reporting obligation?
We can't hear you, Olivier.
I want to know how that this site, I think, my research is for instance, this taking of the taking loan by after having a particular month, this place appears in Calgary. You report that to our site, $10,000 with each of the accounts. Because already, if you look at that, how they operate, once the NRU does not take that comes to the accommodation, unless you that they send you a message that says,
account
balance is this.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
If you make it a transfer from your check account to a savings account, they also show that they are aware that the transaction that is not usual that you have made. So there's those minutes that, we have to find them. So how then do you deal with that situation?
On the first question, the Act doesn't have any obligation on the institution to terminate a relationship, except for the instance where they're not convinced that they know who they're dealing with. It's only where they can't identify the customer or doubt arise about what the customer told them in the beginning, and they're actually not sure that they know who they are, that they are at the end of the relationship. But when these sort of patterns happen, the institution in fact, I mean, the sections that he was reporting says this very clearly, the institution actually carried on doing business with this customer. So there's definitely no expectation that the institution must terminate the relationship. If I see that there's some errors in not continuing a particular transaction, if I see that I have to intervene and stop the transaction, but that's not terminating a relationship, that's just stopping one transaction, freezing one account or something to that extent. So there isn't an obligation on the institution to terminate relationships because they're possibly being suspicious. And in some instances, if the suspicious nature becomes serious enough, the institution might say, I don't want to do business with this stuff, and then they might withdraw or terminate the relationship. But that certainly doesn't happen in the relationship. It's nearly reported that FIC gets, I mean, we get thousands and thousands and thousands of suspicious requests and reports, but there's no expectation that the institution stops business doing business with those customers. On the second question, this obligation doesn't necessarily mean that the institution must report every change or must report everything that is not explained or every sort of spike in abnormal impact customer behavior. But the institution definitely has to pay attention to that and make a decision whether there's something that merits reporting or not. It's very important, and we've said it many times in guidance to institutions as well, that they don't report things that they don't believe in suspicious. That they don't simply report things or things that they don't believe is unexplained or unusual for the customer. Because they are only protected in terms of their customer confidentiality obligations if they report as the Act requires. If they report outside of what the Act requires, they're actually liable to the customer. So they must make sure that they have a justified case when they report something to their customer.
Yeah, sure.
You know,
this
was a really important when a client is doing money laundering, he or she is not going to see all the answers in how the next service. They're not paying attention to the trail of it. But an individual can come to me and say, can I use your account to make a deposit? Can I use your account to make a deposit? Because I'm in a place and I can't remember my account number. And I want you to make this transaction on my behalf using your account number. When you look at it can be five different individuals being requested to do the same transaction of a million dollars to you as the institution to look my news. Because it will not be a whole sum of a million dollars being transacted at once, but it might be four or five different persons transacting on the application in the year. And I'm not trying to suggest that if you get a camera approach that will make sense with it. Right? Because I want to stay within the object that we're not trying to be primitive to what the financial sector. But then how do you shut down such an activity? Where a new advice has been divided into four into the next single person transaction is 2,000 percent. A normal transaction. What does the law say? Do you have the individual? Because you can't say to me where you get that money from and why it's attracted to a certain institution or a certain company. I believe we should find a way of checking the consistency of such activity. I don't know how. I'm not making a suggestion. So that it doesn't stick to the finger. Because it's not really obvious. It's not really as simple as ABC that man can't even out of the I know already it's very difficult for me. So the fact that every time when I make a transfer to my savings account, they arrest me. That's financial education really on that activity is that. That's why if you remember at the beginning, I said, what is the relationship between those who specifically look at wrongful activities and those who have financial conduct without measures? Of course, when you try to legislate, there's also an intended consequence, you know. Maybe we should always be flexible on how we do it and allow the law to create space in an event that investigation should be done. It should be done without the law making it difficult to meet or the law being abused in the process. Because this is a very, very, very important argument that it speaks to us.
I think that's entirely true. This is a new element in the FACIAC now, and is one of the very important sort of innovations from our perspective in the FACIAC, because our understanding of the suggestions we've learned is that one doesn't catch a money launderer on one activity wants it that strongly. The only way they start repeating things and think they're going to get away with it, that they need to maintain a particular profile, or otherwise things start not making sense in the institution and things about them reporting. So this issue of ongoing due diligence and spotting when a person is no longer able to maintain the lie that they told the institution that the outset of a relationship, or where they're not, no longer able to maintain using those resources or the proxy people that they can use as intermediaries, that the behavior needs to change, that it becomes noticeable. And that's when the institutions normally pick up and report to the FIC. Which institutions, many of the more sophisticated institutions currently do because they do it to protect themselves. But it's not a legal obligation for them to do that. That's why we're bringing that feature into the FIC.
What about
Colin's
point that you're not going to make yourself vulnerable to being detected? So you get 5 people to report the media. You have an answer to that.
So I think that the only way that would be picked up is if those 5 people have never transacted in that particular manner before, or in those denominations or in those conferences or volumes, and now suddenly things are changing, and that change becomes sort of a repetitive pattern.
My point is, presumably the person will find somebody who can transact a million runs without it being seen as unusual or unexpected. So he's not going to choose, or she's not going to choose, if he, you know, shows that he was vulnerable to being identified. What happens in that situation? That's exactly how I think it happens. I mean, which money laundering fool will do it in his cup or the cup?
Just working that, that is why using institutions that deal in large volumes of cash businesses are very attractive for money laundering. I think some businesses of institutions that can justify why they have large amounts of cash. And in those cases, it's very difficult to pick up. We probably will only the best position we would be to pick that up is if institutions do the due diligence on who the customers are and who sits behind the customer's property. If the customer lies and doesn't or is not forthcoming with that information, then our chances of catching that also diminish. But we can't deal with that. So
I'm trying to follow up.
Yeah, precisely the point why we say the institutions must accept why we want to be better on the discussion is either whether some shoes or people are related or the national alternatives behind the company. Because if you don't amplify this point, it will not make sense why when you do it with users you want to get the customers. Because it's precisely that when this activity takes place, they will visualize...
No, we see this because there are some issues we have to discuss. You're going to be back to the day. Yeah, because we're finishing in 10 minutes.
It's precisely because they will not use the country of the
Republic.
They will do it in some way, you know, when you look at their books, it looks like the Republic of the Republic, right? So the issue is that we need to explain to the institution that we're not trying to make a cumbersome legislation, but to try and follow very carefully on certain activities that takes place. Because they are there, they are listening, and they are in the very sophisticated manner by people who know even the system themselves. They find people who can do it within an end for them, you know. And the other day, this is something like when I make anecdotes, and I use anecdotes to emphasize my point most of the time. I was watching some strange show on TV about the American celebrity. And I picked up an
interview. Why are you not reading the bill at this
time? No, sir, but that's what makes it. You know this anecdote you have to deal with. But you know, this lady ran away from Canada. She was a banker. She got involved with Nigerian syndicates who made her to bank money. Without looking
for... He's a very cultural figure, that's
what
No, you see that. I was okay, go ahead.
I
was not talking about Nigeria. Not this was about Nigeria. It could have been Nigeria. It could have been anybody else. But the gist of the matter is that here are the Nigerian economic bank who assisted criminals to transact. That's the point I'm saying.
Yeah, I know.
Going into detail. But here's the banker who assisted criminals to transact.
Presumably you're implying if it's not a Nigerian, it has to be a South African.
No! I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, but I hope the Wolf will ask whoever the Wolf can. Why you're not being the Wolf instead of what you've seen? Right, but that's another question. So, Mari,
if you all right, this is my maiden speech.
Please go ahead.
Now, I just want to have one small understanding before. And my point is that the linkage of the laws of donation in the government country, or rather the progressiveness of the deal, and the new form of pyramid schemes. I'm saying this thing because of the new development, where money does not translate as money, but people develop pyramid schemes that sort of don't give money at the court. At a particular time, money will then move from country to
country.
So I'm just trying to have this understanding of what you're trying to close here. Are you not backwards in fact, versus in the current development? If you look at the current development, I mean, the experience of the super currency now, that even the banking sector, even here, I think it's happening in here. One example of the is of the triple M scheme, which is a Russian bank scheme that was taken in strategy. So I'm trying to understand the phenomenon of that has been in fact speaks to this kind of development that I live in now. It's not. Therefore, it means we're a little bit better. But nonetheless, you know, I'm just going to say, and I've just noted another point. And my point must not take it backward.
No, go ahead.
But that's the point that
I've got. So, man, we understand you just came in now. And you'll find your feet, and we're going to help you to do that after this meeting. But respond to the issues, eh?
Yeah, I think that's really difficult. Our expectation is certainly not that these provisions will catch each and every criminal. We are hoping it will improve our chances of doing so, and especially in the context of pyramid schemes. It's something that we've picked up quite a few reports on from institutions that report on things that they believe are pyramid schemes, so we are able to provide information to the Reserve Bank, especially that follow up and the Financial Services Board that follow up on those investigations. But most of those have been where this sort of ongoing due diligence points to the institution that a person is doing something with their money which they haven't done before. That doesn't make sense for this person to do, especially if they have fairly low income earners that start making donations to people or things like that. It's very difficult to pick up because the transactions are relatively small. And if they have, you have to have a large number of those transactions happening just with the two or three different institutions that bank accounts to which the money or to which the money flows. In those cases, we have a chance of picking it up, but it's very difficult to see them at the beginning stage. And it's usually only seen at the end when a lot of money is at stake and people are actually losing a lot. So that's unfortunate for us.
And the pyramid schemes and so on, presumably it's covered with other legislation, right? But here, is there a role that we have through this FIC? And have you been dealing with those issues? Because he's right. I mean, there's a lot of abuse of money, use of financial institutions to do that, although the financial system has got to be blamed. You know, respond to that end of time. What I'd like to say, colleagues, we've got less than 6 minutes, and we've got an in-house matter to deal with. And we must finish at 1 because we're going to start a group meeting and then people have to go for their lunch. So I'd like to suggest we don't vote on this matter. We leave this thing in suspension, and what we do is that we pick up where we left off. So very quickly, can you reply to Samai and to Kandi in a nutshell, the other two said, and then we'll pick it up where, but we're not adopting the course in the past yet.
The FHR doesn't specifically address certain schemes that fall under the Bank Act mainly because it's a contravention of the banking business without the banking license, or it could be under the FSC legislation providing financial advice or brokering services without the license. We often find out about these schemes when they're well in advance or have been carrying on for a long while. And from the FHR side, we can normally, when we know after the fact that the schemes have been traced back how the money flowed and who's the parties that are responsible. So we often assist with investigations in the FSB or the Reserve Bank to identify who's the person that's actually the mind or the criminal behind the scheme, because we can track how the money ended up there. But it's very difficult for us to see it in advance and to prevent it from happening.
I'm finding this is going to say anything more than it's just said. Okay, so we'll come back to the point she's raising are relevant. You see, Yvette?
Just some experience in the banking sector. So we put daily transaction monitoring. So this comes to the point where we open an account and the client has certain information. We look at what transactions are going through the account, and from there we can pick up that this could be a Ponzi scheme. The difficulty sitting at this point in time is that as a financial institution, you have got no legal authority to freeze that account.
Oh, yeah.
So we need to report that account to the Reserve Bank and to the FIC. They need to do investigation, and then only can the account be frozen. By that time, we have in many occasions seen that millions have already left the account, where we could have, if we had the power, we could have frozen it before and investigated.
Thank you. I've just gotten an email from a client of Nedbank in the Free State who said they account frozen for the last 2 months and they cannot get this account unblocked because of missing IDs or something like this. It is so frustrating. I had another complaint on the Eastern Cape. Over Christmas, I spent 2 days of my holiday doing nothing else but trying to deal with net banking. It has been the most frustrating thing. And there they're just freezing accounts. And so, that, you know, I mean, right now I'm very angry having just got this. I've been dealing with this particular one for the last 2 weeks. I can't get through to my phone, but I think I must now make a bigger effort to get through because it's just unacceptable.
Oh, but you can deal with it on present
meeting.
Types of freezing. Yeah, I know what you're going to say. All right, look, we're running out of time. Firstly, can you leave as soon as possible because there's an AC study group meeting? The faster you leave, the quicker you can go for lunch. Now, the first thing, colleagues, is you have a program, right? Here's the program. It was sent to the GH from a front. You just remind me. We got no comments. It's drafted after consultation with the GH. So here's the program. You've got with you, right? So we might have to make a few changes. A lot of people are listening. Because apparently I'm now told that the last week has now become a constituency week. I'm surprised to hear that, right? So that means the sittings of Tuesday and Wednesday, 22nd, 23rd, I don't know what we do. Yeah, it's a committee meeting at this stage. Sitting week, colleagues, as you know, you have to look at the earlier part. And if you can kindly look at that. Secondly, I'd like to say to people that we have some very bad news. If people are listening, please, because the meeting's not over. You can leave, but for the committee, you need to know that Bridget is leaving us effectively on Friday. She's going to the Northwest to serve as an advisor in the Premier's office. And we are very, very sorry that she's leaving us. We will miss her very much. And I think we all wish her well in the new role, which starts, I think, on the 1st of March. I have no time now, but I'll report to you on what we're doing about staff issues, but I want to alert the meeting to this. But I think we should agree. We should agree. My colleague Bridget is leading up on the 1st of March. She's going to the Northwest Province. And we will...
Congratulations to our people, yes. But I also think then that we have to be clear that the committee can only move at a pace at which we get the necessary support services. This morning I'm horrified to hear there's another bill coming. And I think what we should take a decision on is that if necessary we'll have 1 hour meetings if it comes to it, or half an hour meeting. We will only do work provided we get the support. So it's a sort of go slow. It's never been done in this parliament. I've alerted all the powers that be apart from the speaker. Apart from the work to work. Apart from the speaker, I've notified everybody. I will have another meeting with the chief work to tell him we cannot continue like this. I have communicated to the minister, to Gerard Connaught yesterday, that we cannot manage any more bills this year. Okay? Are we agreeing with that? We cannot manage any more bills this year. We've already got so many, I don't know what you know what you let yourself in for yet.
Okay.
So basically, this is the program. I take it. Also, by the way, that I'm saying in caucus, our caucus now. The other thing to say is, I want to make it utterly clear, PMG.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. There are things circulating in the media, in the public domain, that we are going to rush this. Let's call it Providence Fund Bill. There's no such thing. Now, I want to get something very clear. I have conferred with Advocate Jenkins at all times. I had a long discussion with him last week, Wednesday, Thursday, and again this morning. As I understand his colleagues, the Leader of Government Business Parliamentary Council told me they're going to fast track that bill. But fast tracking really means we have to prioritize. We are not going to in any way pass that bill by the 1st of March. It's impossible. Tomorrow or Thursday, the minister will introduce the bill. Only after that it can be ATC, which is on Thursday morning. So, the public hearings that we had in mind for the 29th, we are going to defer. Because unless the DA cooperates, we can't go ahead with it. Or the opposite, but the multi-party negotiating team of the programming work and the chief of office will discuss it this week. So, we have suggested the treatment after my having discussed with Elf and he agreed, but I think subsequently in their caucus they might have changed their view, I don't know. So, colleagues, we don't know whether we're going ahead on Monday the 29th. Because we don't know the caucus and opposition parties are coming over here. But knowing what is intended that we'll pass the bill in both houses and promulgated by the 1st of March. In any case, this afternoon is getting a strike. What I want to tell colleagues also is that I want to remind you that only with textbooks, I don't know anywhere else in this parliament, we've always been looking at informal drafts. It isn't time to discuss it now, it's only 1 o'clock. But the procedure that we had in mind, which was public hearings on the 29th, beginning to discuss the bill on the 29th and passing it reasonably soon after that, is not at all irregular. And in fact, we have been doing that all along, looking at, can you explain in 1 minute what we are saying is 1 o'clock already?
Mr. Chair, on the first issue of fast-tracking, I've handed to Alan just a copy of the drawing tools. This is in fact quite a cumbersome process, is to get it into the food of the prospect. So I just want to put that out there. The second issue is just what we've usually done in this committee is to receive what's called revenue proposals in the budget speech in February. Then we'll receive draft taxation laws and then we'll go on the draft taxation law administration bill.
And we have public hearings on that.
Then we have a public hearings on that, sir, as corrected when the bill is formally introduced. The outline we will read some of the public hearings, but it's truncated. It takes us forward to see what has changed from June to September, what has the minister changed, and we focus on that. In this instance, there might not be any change, and we want to deal with it like we usually deal with it there. Public consultation was done, so there will be no change in the bill. Of course, people can still write to the committee, and it's not close, but we move forward, and that's how we usually deal with taxation issues in this committee.
Can I suggest that instead of having a long discussion, do we agree that no matter how important this bill may be seen by whoever,
we are going to stick to the rules and conventions of Parliament and the legislation that applies to processing bills in a way that is ensuring public participation. If we go in there and ignore those things, somebody will take us to court and then we're shooting ourselves in the foot. Can the members please agree to listen so that we agree collectively? Nobody should then say, I didn't understand what we did. The proposal is that we proceed with the bill as an important bill and we try to process it expeditiously, but in a way that's consistent with the rules, the conventions and the norms that have been adopted about public consultation. Are we agreeing on that? Because if we shoot ahead, somebody will take us to court and say there's no public consultation. I would like to suggest we can finish on our side this bill. We'll have to sit outside those times that are there in the program before the middle of, by the middle of March, I think we'll have done on our side with the bill. I don't see why we can't. My understanding is that it's a deferment, right? Although Kuzar was not happy with it, they must come to the public hearing and present their case. So I want to explain that issue. We have some meeting decision here that we are going to stick with the conventions and rules and that we'll seek to finish the bill by, let's say, the 14th of March. Which means we can do it before that, but our outer deadline is the 14th of March. I want to tell people that both industry and the trade union movements, it's in their self-interest that we finish the bill quickly. You see, industry is seized up with us because they feel, in polite terms, that we are held for ransom by society and we are cowards and so on, we should go ahead with this. But now that they know it's very likely that will happen, that we will defer it for 2 years, or who knows what Parliament will decide, I'm not going to scrap the whole provision, I don't know. They feel, since that's going to happen for what they can tell, they feel for their own purposes, for what I know, that we might as well do it quickly, although we don't approve of it. So,
what is that arrangement? I know that's not our arrangement, but I think it's sort of my duty. But, you know, if you have to process the deal and go in there, but it's when they have done their
exactly our point. If you look at this book, I don't know for you, this book, 4 out of 5 times, Basra and Afisa raised things with Tracy when they drafted this bill and gave them news a year ago. They rejected it. Now we tell them to go and talk, they suddenly agree. There was something to come before. Now I also get that the bill is not taking the letter. And I also give you the letter. And it's not a requirement of the executive to take the letter. Parties in the letter are saying that we wanted to see the draft. And we haven't seen it. Now, there's no obligation on the minister to necessarily keep it together. And there's no obligation on Parliament. I also want to alert you to something. I'm sending you the report to remind you and our underlying sections of our level of degree of consultation. There have been statements made in the media, which I don't think Parliament can, nobody can actually shrink from reporting on, that the MPs were sleeping. I raised it to the people concerned when the bill was being processed, that there wasn't consultation. And I'm just going to repeat what you report. I've said it to some of you. I don't know how much more consultation is. It's been 4 years, 3 years since the bill. Actually, the law was adopted in 2013. And we postponed it in 2014 for a year. So what I'm saying is, I will make it very clear when the public hearing starts. Here's our report for the consultation. So let's move on then to closing the meeting and starting our other meeting. I say this because Beth led the process initially, by the way, and so on. And I don't think Parliament must shrink from making clear to whoever the name. That's our report. It makes it clear what we did. Over to you,
Thank you. I don't want to take too much of your time, but I
had a discussion this morning. The Deputy Minister of Justice has bumped into the House. His view is that, precisely like you said, it's been on the statute book, it was then suspended, now it's coming back in. There's no need for public consultation in that specific instance. I disagree with it. If somebody challenges the court's poison as well, fine. Ask Parliament, what did you do in this specific instance? Where the bill has gone from A to B and back to A. That in terms of the fact that every bill coming to Parliament is at least invited stakeholders for public participation. That's a constitutional obligation. I want to add to that, if we look at those rules that I've handed out, never mind if we're going to follow them or not, but what's interesting in those rules, Chairperson, is when it comes to past tracking, we look at Joint Rule 216-7, and there it says clearly that this rule does not apply to a bill classified as being subject to Section 18 of the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework. So in other words, if you have to do that 30 days for the National House of Traditional Leaders to comment, you must do that. You can't pass that beyond that. And that's the rule, and it's based on a piece of legislation. But that piece of legislation, the principle in there, is what we call sort of extra parliamentary consultation, the statutory obligation for consultation. And for me, there's no difference between that and the Doctors for Life requirement that Parliament must consult in every book. So you cannot, in my view, comply with that constitutional obligation by referring to this. It's a new book. People might have an opportunity to say something on the book.
It's a matter of 2 weeks, colleagues. So for 2 weeks, I don't think it's worth it. The chief book, by the way, of the ANC agrees. I've been conferring with him since Wednesday night. So from the ANC side, unless the powers that be change their view, we do public hearings with appropriate notice. We're not meeting on Monday the 29th, but we will finish the bill by middle of March. It's not a big deal. I have communicated to the ministry and so on. I've been engaging the minister, Africa Jenkins, members of the executive, leader of government business, and I've suggested to them this is the rules, but there are people who feel we must destroy and process the vote. There's no need for public hearings. I heard that one. I don't think we're going to agree with that. But fine, that's done. Thank you. Can the ANC members be maybe on the 7th of January? But we have mandate to come.
Especially